We do. The new series of More or Less with me, Tim Harford, starting next Wednesday morning at 9. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 3rd of September. This is Today with Emma Barnett in the studio, Nick Robinson here in the British Museum, standing next to the Bayeux Tapestry, which was unveiled last night for the King, the Queen, the President of France and the Prime Minister.
Looking forward to hearing more about that throughout the programme. The headlines today, the BBC has learned that people smugglers in France are running low on boats as the British and French governments announce more police officers to try to stop mega dinghies from carrying migrants across the Channel. We'll be having a special report from the beaches where overcrowded boats are setting off for Britain.
The boat is looking quite overloaded now. Its black sides are becoming increasingly submerged in the water. They're now trying to inch back to my right to pick up another group of people.
More than 600 employers, including B&Q, have been named and shamed by the government for failing to pay the national minimum wage. And also in today's programme, what did the Vice President of the United States mean when he said this?
I think that there are like things about the world that make me feel like not shocked if the Antichrist was walking among us. Mm. But again, I try not to focus too much on it.
And he also talked about the end of the world as well. More on that from his friend of J.D. Vance after 8:30.
Meantime, we'll be live here at the British Museum as a special Norman Day begins on Radio 4 to celebrate the historic return of the Bayeux Tapestry, which for nearly a millennium has never left French shores. It is, of course, a monument of and about an ancient war, but the French culture minister tells us that cultural connections, like the one that led to the loan of this artwork, will prevent future conflict.
What I would say is that culture is what remains when everything else has been forgotten. We can fight against each other, but we can find common ground on common taste, on poetry.
All 70 metres of this ancient linen embroidery are laid out here next to me, but intriguingly, they are undercover. So I am waiting to see them when they're unveiled just before 8 o'clock, and we'll bring you the reaction of three school children from Hastings seeing the tapestry for the very first time, as well as hearing that interview with the culture minister from the chair of the British Museum and one of the curators of an exhibition which is expected to welcome 1 million visitors. All that after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
BBC News has found criminal groups who smuggle people to the UK across the English Channel are running low on boats, which is in part leading them to use bigger, more crowded vessels. In an attempt to tackle the mega dinghies, Britain and France will today announce that dozens more officers will be deployed on French beaches to stop the launches. Our Paris correspondent James Waterhouse reports from northern France.
People smugglers are frustrated and have told our sources they're having to change tactics. It's thought greater enforcement action has contributed to them running out of boats. They're instead using larger vessels, and these are departing from areas away from the Calais to Dunkirk stretch to try to avoid the French police. They're also charging the migrants more, now up to €2,000 each, and pressuring them to pay in cash instead of making money transfers. Migrants are now often having to wait months instead of weeks to successfully cross and are often staying closer to the beach to improve their chances of making a journey.
The latest initiative to try to stop the small boat crossings comes as Andy Burnham prepares to host the French President Emmanuel Macron at Downing Street for the first time since becoming Prime Minister. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
Last night, the President and the Prime Minister admired the Bayeux Tapestry on loan to the British Museum. Today they'll focus not on historic cross-channel conflict, but contemporary cooperation. The UK and France are to boost police numbers to stop the launch of mega dinghies from the French coast. Downing Street said a surge team of 45 French officers would be deployed in the coming weeks, and that a total of more than 1,000 personnel were now involved in attempting to stop the boats. While the number of crossings was at a 7-year low this summer, the Prime Minister has said the UK can't be complacent. The Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Philp, said the government had failed to smash the gangs and that UK financial support should be withheld until the French authorities prevent all embarkations in shallow waters.
The King has described the loan of the Bayeux Tapestry as the best possible symbol of the lasting bond between the UK and France. He had a private viewing of the medieval treasure along with President Macron and Andy Burnham at the British Museum last night. The tapestry, which tells the story of the Norman conquest, goes on public display next week. Our culture editor Katie Razzle sent this report from the British Museum.
The King and Queen, the Prime Minister and the French President, with other dignitaries, toured the nearly 70-metre-long artwork, which is laid flat for the first time to protect it from gravity, as curators shared the stories it tells. The King spoke of the enduring bond between the two countries that began 1,000 years ago. The loan of the fragile medieval treasure was pushed through by President Macron against some vocal opposition. He told assembled guests the tapestry was a reminder of what France and Britain could do when the two nations stood together.
The Conservatives have outlined how they would raise £10 billion a year to hit the target of spending 3% of the UK's economy on defence by 2030. They say the funds would come from a series of measures, including reforming housing benefit, reimposing the two-child benefit cap and scrapping the Chagos deal. The government said Britain's defences wouldn't be funded by what it called dodgy Tory economics. Kuwait says it has intercepted a missile and drone attack from Iran, the latest flare-up in violence in the Middle East. Iranian state television said Tehran was targeting US bases in Kuwait in response to what it described as America's crimes against the Iranian people. On Tuesday night, the US and Iran carried out their biggest exchange of attacks since July, with Tehran claiming that a wedding in the south of the country was hit. The Pentagon insists it doesn't target civilians. The government has named and shamed more than 600 employers who failed to pay their staff the legal minimum wage. Over an undisclosed period, some companies have underpaid workers by hundreds of thousands of pounds. Here's our business reporter, Emma Morrow.
Today's list from the Department for Business and Trade includes several NHS trusts, nursing homes and other social care providers, and childcare businesses. In total, £4 million in wages has been repaid to more than 27,000 workers following enforcement action. The employers named have also been issued penalties totalling £7 million. But the DIY chain B&Q owed the most, having failed to pay more than £450,000 to over 4,000 workers. The company said the shortfalls were unintentional and staff were paid what they were owed in July last year.
A US judge has ordered jurors to make a final attempt to reach a verdict in the murder trial of a mother who killed her three children. Lindsay Clancy has admitted strangling her children in their Massachusetts home in 2023, but pleaded not guilty to murder by reason of insanity, arguing she was suffering from postnatal psychosis. President Trump has said he's happy that Prince Harry and his wife Meghan have left the United States and moved back to the UK. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex returned last week with their two children, 6 years after they stepped back from royal duties and relocated to California. Mr. Trump said he wasn't a fan of how the couple acted.
I thought they treated the royal family with great disrespect. I didn't like it. I didn't like the way she acted. I thought she was terribly disrespectful to the Queen, to King Charles. And Maybe I'm different. I wouldn't have taken him back.
Tennis, the British number one Katie Bolter managed to win just one game in her second round defeat at the US Open. Three other British players, Jacob Fernley, Toby Samuel and Jan Chwinski, were also knocked out on the fourth day of the competition. Francesca Jones was the only British player to progress, reaching the second round after winning her rain-delayed match against Poland's Magda Linette.
Jane, thanks very much. At 8 minutes past six... let's get the latest on the weather, shall we? I don't actually know what to wear at the moment, Chris Fawkes. He's at the weather sensor for us. What do we do, Chris? Drenched yesterday.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, there was some wet weather around, wasn't there? Do you know, today is one of those days where we are going to see further changes, actually, hour by hour. Now, this morning, for many areas of the UK, it's going to be quite a grey start to the day. We have quite extensive low clouds, some patches of drizzle around. Some of the damp weather across northeast England, parts of northeast Scotland and southern areas of England with the drizzle. We've also got some fog patches in the southwest. So quite a murky start for a number. But I think as we go on through the morning, for the first few hours, many areas will see the low cloud lift and break, with spells of sunshine developing pretty widely. Now, there will be some heavier rain for a time pushing across Orkney and Shetland this morning. That will eventually clear out of the way, but probably not before the afternoon. Sunny spells then developing for most areas of the UK for a time, but later on this afternoon, we are going to see further changes. A band of heavier rain is going to spread to Northern Ireland, northwest England, and move into the far north of Wales by the end of the day. At the same time, there'll be a number of heavy showers working into western areas of Scotland, with a risk of one or two of those turning thundery. The sunshine will eventually come out across southern areas of England, but I think taking quite a long time to shift the low cloud here. So a changeable kind of day for many. Now, our temperatures for Northern Ireland, Scotland, northwest England and Wales, 18 to 22, feeling warm in any sunshine. For the Midlands, East Anglia, southeast England, our temperatures could reach 22 to as high as 26 Celsius, feeling a little on the humid side. Further outbreaks of rain overnight, pushing southwards across England and Wales, and tomorrow it's a day of sunshine and showers, with most of the showers in the north and the west. That's the latest.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. It is now 6:10. The words behind me on the wall here at the British Museum read, "Soaked in blood, the flower of England's nobility and youth covered the ground far and wide." There are words a million visitors are expected to see over the next few months. They were written by William of Poitiers almost 1,000 years ago to describe the Battle of Hastings in the year which is said to be the nation's favourite pin code, 1066. We're broadcasting this morning from the Long Gallery, the new temporary home to the Bear Tapestry. Last night, His Majesty the King, the Queen and the Prime Minister joined President Macron and his wife Brigitte to walk the 70-metre length and to admire the craftsmanship and the storytelling of the embroiderers. Speaking from a podium in front of flags of both nations and the European Union, all three leaders spoke of the tapestry and its loan as symbols of friendship between nations. President Macron extolled the bond between France and the UK, which he said was as close as the threads in the tapestry.
Long live culture. Long live the friendship between France and the United Kingdom. Longue vie à l'entente cordiale et longue vie à l'entente amicale.
L'entente amicale, a phrase used by the King as well. He called the loan of this tapestry the best possible symbol of the closeness between Britain and France.
May this tapestry and the treasures that will travel in return stand as symbols not only of our shared past, but our shared future. A future woven, as it should be, by Britain and France together.
The Prime Minister thanked France for the loan of the tapestry, a loan which President Macron joked had taken longer to negotiate than even Brexit. Andy Burnham called it a tremendous demonstration of goodwill. But he couldn't resist beginning with a joke about the echoes between the history on display here and more recent events in Westminster.
A tapestry that shows a new leader emerging from a northern territory, travelling to the south of England in search of the crown. Something clearly that couldn't happen today.
After he chatted to school children from a school, some of whom we're going to be meeting later on the programme, I caught up with him amongst the hubbub.
You had a nice jag at your own expense.
A little. Yeah. You've got to, haven't you? But it's just a wonderful occasion, this, isn't it? It's real history. And it's a good reminder that we're all bound up together, aren't we, in these divisive times in which we've lived. Delve back a bit and you see we're all mixed up together. And I thought the words of the French president were really inspiring, actually. So it's great to host him. He's made a huge gesture towards Britain. And it's good to be able to thank him tonight in person for that.
And he'll have the chance to thank him again this morning when President Macron becomes the first world leader to meet our new Prime Minister in Downing Street. On their agenda, the wars in the Middle East and Ukraine, defence, energy, the economy and, of course, the small boats. We'll be talking about that over the next 3 hours, but we'll also be sharing the joy that this new exhibition is already bringing with the French Culture Minister, with the curator and chair of the British Museum, and a group of school children from Hastings who will, Emma, when they finally take off the cloths here on the 70 metres of glass box, see this tapestry with me for the very first time.
There you go. 14 minutes past six. Let's go to some of those issues Nick was just raising by way of the morning papers, and many of the newspapers reflecting actually on what Andy Burnham was doing before he went to the British Museum, which was the first Prime Minister's questions session of his tenure in the Commons. I'm still thinking about the fact that Chris Mason, our political editor, said from Tony Blair's memoir yesterday it was a bowel-moving event for him. The Guardian says Andy Burnham used it to try and calm the bond markets ahead of his first budget. The I paper has warned he might need to raise £15 billion in taxes to fund high borrowing costs. The Times highlights the warning from the Labour chairman of the Commons Defence Committee that vibes alone will not be enough to defend the UK. The Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph say the Conservatives have pledged to reach that target by slashing welfare.
The Daily Express is interested in one potential area of welfare savings, reporting that the Prime Minister's ally, Lord O'Neill, has joined what it calls hysterical calls to drop pensions protection. Voters would punish you if the triple lock goes, it warns Mr. Burnham.
The Sun says that an extra surge of French police to tackle the small boats crisis will consist of what it calls just 45 do-nothing cops, something we'll put to a minister after 8 o'clock. It draws on images of ships arriving, wait for it, from the Bay of Tapestry to illustrate the story and urges the Prime Minister to prevent a stitch-up by the French. Recalling King Harold's fate, it describes Mr. Macron's promise as one in the eye for Andy.
The headline writers were clearly busy yesterday. The Daily Mail reports criticism from the Conservatives of what the Tories call a massive new quango to reform the civil service. It quotes the First Secretary of State, Louise Hague, as saying the government needs to tear away red tape. The paper's cartoonist Pew pictures one MP telling another, "We've commissioned a quango to reduce our quangos."
Moving to The Guardian, it says the Green Party leader in England and Wales, Zach Polanski, has moved a step closer to his quest to become an MP. It says party members in the seat vacated by Sir Keir Starmer are supporting him to become their candidate to replace him. But The Times says his hopes could be scuppered because some of his own party members would prefer a Palestinian candidate or a pro-Gaza independent.
The Daily Mirror says the Argentinian midfielder Enzo Fernandez has burnt his bridges, making a departing dig at Chelsea as he signed for Manchester City for a record fee. Stinging the Blues is the Star's headline.
There you go. It's 16 minutes past six. Let's turn our attentions and return our attentions, I should say, to Nepal. The United Nations says its response to last week's devastating flash floods on the Nepal-Tibet border is now focused on the recovery of bodies rather than rescue efforts. More than 1,000 people were killed in the disaster. Steve McDonnell is our China correspondent. Steve, what can you tell us?
Well, I'll start with the Tibetan side of the border. The official death toll remains at 21, but with 541 people missing. So the real death toll in Tibet is going to be much, much higher than the official toll. Emergency teams haven't found any survivors there since last week, so it would take an absolute miracle to find any more survivors there. And what the People's Liberation Army are saying is similar to on the other side of the border, on the Nepal side of the border. They're now prioritising the living on helping out survivors and also looking for and identifying any other bodies they find. So they say they're prioritising disease prevention, providing shelters, medical support. They're testing water and food quality, and also providing psychological support for the survivors. They've found hundreds of belongings, which they're now using for sort of the grim task of matching belongings with those who are missing. So 847 items, apparently, to be used to hopefully work out the list of people who really have died, to tell families that their loved ones are sadly not coming back. The People's Armed Police have, a whole bunch of them have trekked in to help out with the disinfection of the area. And there's a hotline set up as well. Now, this hotline is to provide assistance for those with missing family members. Apparently, 876 calls have been made to that hotline including 428 from overseas. So it just shows how many foreigners must be amongst the 541 still listed as missing on the Tibetan side of the border. I think at some point we'll turn to the causes of this, and decisions will be made about whether hydroelectric schemes should be in that area or where border posts should be positioned and what have you. But right now, it's very much a focus on the survivors and making sure that you can do everything you can to help them out.
Steve McDonald, indeed, our China correspondent. Thank you.
It's 19 minutes past six when the leaders of Britain and France meet at Downing Street today. They and other world leaders will be keeping a very nervy eye, I suspect, on the bond markets. The cost of 10-year government borrowing hit its highest level since the financial crisis yesterday, which has led to more warnings about the impact on the nation's finances. Sean can tell us more about that and the rest of the morning's business news. Morning, Sean.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, it depends sort of what term of government borrowing, what length of period the government will be borrowing for that you look at when you want to see how much these records are being broken or when was the last time we hit a certain level. So yesterday it was that 10-year government bond or gilt, the interest rate on that peaking at just over 5.29% at one point. So not seen those levels since the financial crisis. We've been talking this week already about how longer term borrowing, some of those interest rate levels have been at points that we've not seen since the late 90s. We've had Andy Burnham's former economic advisor, Lord O'Neill, describing some of these new policies from the new Prime Minister as the last thing the markets need. Laura Lambie, Senior Investment Director at Rathbones, is with me. Laura, so what are investors looking for right now?
I expect they are looking for inflation being higher for longer due to inflated oil prices. That has implications for interest rates, which also look as if they're going to be higher for longer, which has implications for government borrowing, company borrowing and consumer mortgages. So fairly significant.
Is there an urgency from investors to hear about Andy Burnham's plans and his Chancellor's plans, you know, almost before a budget at the end of next month? We're starting to hear what some of the Conservative Party's proposals are for saving money in one area to pay for defence spending. Do investors need that?
I think investors need to be assured that the books are going to be balanced. Obviously, it's more expensive for governments to borrow as interest rates go up, so that also has to be factored in. And, you know, as I say, the markets, the bond markets in particular, in all countries are concerned about the levels of borrowing in comparison to a country's GDP.
And as we look this morning, the price of a barrel of Brent crude still around that $95 level, so still, you know, higher than we've been used to last year, and still not to fall into the levels that many would like it to ease the pressure on inflation as well. Laura, thank you very much for your time this morning. Laura Lambie from Rathbones there, the boss of one of America's biggest tech companies, Hewlett-Packard Enterprises. So that's not the laptops business. That's a different company, though, with a shared history. The boss of this HPE has said that political uncertainty in the UK has been a problem for investment in AI infrastructure. So HPE is a company worth £50 billion, employs 67,000 people globally, provides a lot of the expertise that goes into building and running data centres, so crucial in the advancement of these artificial intelligence tools. And the chief executive, Antonio Neri, told us that long-term projects like data centres need certainty, need continuity. Political instability here has been a problem for this. We were speaking as the company revealed sales up more than a third after record demand, and I started by asking him if all this spending on AI is actually sustainable.
We believe in this technology. They went from proof of concept now to workflow transformation. I don't see this as another IT innovation. I see that as an opportunity to transform your enterprise. And then obviously there is the sovereign part of this, governments that understand that this technology can disrupt many things, and therefore they want to make sure they are protected. And we see that in defense. Obviously, we see that across the government structures. We as a company, as an example, we are aggressively deploying AI across our enterprise, and we have more than 1,200 use cases already in the works with more than 300 in production. That's what we see, and that's why we believe this is durable.
We've had our own Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, warned just in recent days of what could be a big worldwide future market correction. You know, almost every day for feels like years now, we've talked about some major growth in the world of AI. He's concerned that if there's a collapse in growth, there could be a huge ripple effect. So how do you protect against that if you have central bank governors seeing this as a growing risk?
Well, obviously, I'm not an economist. What I can tell you is that we have lived technology or major transformation over the centuries. And think about the Industrial Revolution, think about other massive technology that allows us to multiply the growth that each of the economies saw for the next, you know, decades. And so I do believe this is going to be a multiplier of growth. It is not just a productivity improvement that will require, you know, less people in some areas, but actually an accelerator of growth, because we're going to solve problems and create new businesses that we couldn't do at the pace that we were on because we didn't have the technology to do it. So that I am more optimistic about this, but obviously it has to be governed, it has to be managed, and it has to be understood, and it has to be equitable, right? Where all sectors of the society can participate.
How should that be governed? Is it a global regulator?
I don't think so. I mean, you can govern globally everything that's happening in the world and honestly in your own country. I think it is a combination of local regulation with global partnerships and, by the way, between the public and the private sector. Both have equally important responsibilities here. And the reality that the government needs help from the private sector because they are not equipped to understand all this technology evolution, because the technology in many ways is far ahead of the policy.
And hey, people, so, just sorry to interrupt you just on that point, but can you see why people might get concerned that what are a relatively small number of huge technology companies from the United States, maybe from China as well, have so much more power and influence over how things are going to work than the governments that people are voting in have?
Yeah, I can understand some of that, but I think in the end, you can't stop innovation. What you can do is govern it in a way where there is some equality, but ultimately is up to each of the governments and private sector to decide how far they want to go. The pace we are innovating these days is just remarkable. And I speak for myself because, you know, I have seen every inflection point pretty much in my career, and I've never seen at the pace that we've seen in the last 5 years.
How does the UK compare as a place for HPE to invest, for other businesses to be looking at building data centers and increasing investments in this technology compared to other parts of the world where you have a big presence?
Well, first of all, the UK market is very strategic for us. We have a very large presence over many, many decades. We serve some of the largest customers in the UK, from telecommunication to banking to retail to hospitality. We as a company, we don't build our own data centers for consumption. We help companies build data centers. High cost of electricity comes up all the time, and not just in the UK, okay? Clearly, the UK is not one of the lowest cost per kilowatt, but as a matter of attractiveness, there are areas and some innovative approaches like using waste as a way to generate electricity that eventually power these data centers. And there is a company in the UK that we have partnered just because of that.
We discuss planning a lot. How does the UK need to approach this from a planning perspective? And is the environment there to encourage this kind of growth?
You know, it comes down to things like having a set of policies that facilitates permitting, that drives incentives in specific regions of the UK where companies feel compelled to go invest their capital to grow in these areas and create jobs in some of these areas as well. So there has to be a 360 plan associated with that. And then obviously how to facilitate the growth of this infrastructure by thinking about 3 to 5 years out, what it means for energy and other things. You know, once you create that plan, then people draft behind that plan with certainty. Because the problem, I think, the UK has been a little bit unstable from a political perspective as of late, and that has not created continuity. Here, when you invest this amount of money, you have to have certainty and continuity, because much of this technology gets this depreciated over a long period of time, 5, 6, 7 years.
Has this latest change in Prime Minister in the UK kept some continuity, or does it feel to you like it's brought in another level of uncertainty?
I think it's too early to say, to be honest with you. What we would like to see is continuity in the policy and stability in this area, which allows us, but the reality, other companies, to stay focused on executing that thesis in terms of investment and availability of these resources.
Just finally, I just wanted to ask you about developments that we've seen with the Court of Appeal that has just ruled that the family of Mike Lynch can appeal against some narrow parts of a ruling which previously ordered his estate to pay HPE more than $1.2 billion. And just for the context for listeners, Mike Lynch, who died a couple of years ago, he sold his company Autonomy to Hewlett-Packard in 2011, but a civil trial later found that Mr. Lynch and his former CFO had artificially inflated Autonomy's revenues. And his family say that the claim was wildly exaggerated and that any losses stemmed from HP's own conduct after it bought Autonomy. I just wonder what you say to the family of Mike Lynch there.
Well, obviously, it is a very disheartening situation what happened to the individuals that lost their life in that event. But for us, we're looking forward to concluding this matter. From a legal perspective, has passed a long time. And on that aspect, I'm not going to comment further on the legal proceedings because that's not appropriate. And that's in the hands of the courts at this point in time.
That is the chief executive, Antonio Neri, of Hewlett-Packard Enterprises. I'm going to be back after 7 o'clock having a look at what the ripple effects of these higher era of interest rates will have on mortgage rates potentially. Have there been moves quite now? Are they going to be in the weeks to come? So all that after 7.
Very important to hear for us all. Thanks very much, Sean. We'll look forward to that, but at 6:30. Mike is here with the latest on the sport. Morning, Mike.
Hello, Emma. Good morning. It was a mixed day for the British players at the US Open tennis yesterday. There was a chastening defeat for the British number one, Katie Bolter, in the second round. As we heard in the news headlines, she won just one game in a 58-minute demolition by the Wimbledon finalist Karolina Mukova, losing 6-1, 6-love.
She was better than me today, for sure. I struggled with the conditions. I struggled with the roof. I struggled with the noise. I kind of let these little things distract me a little bit. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it was a bad day at the office, times two.
We've all had one of those, I guess. Much better news for Britain's Fran Jones in New York, though. She is through to the second round at the US Open for the very first time.
I want to keep going. This isn't necessarily, the pinnacle of my career, I hope. So certainly a period that you have to enjoy as well, enjoy it whilst it lasts. And I think after those bleak periods at the start of the year, now more than ever I have to take it in. So obviously I don't have the day off anymore, so I have to go again tomorrow, reset, and take it to whoever I play.
Yes, Jones back in action later today. Fellow Brits Jacob Fernley and Jan Chojnicki, though, are both out of the US Open. Fernley was beaten in the second round by Thomas Martin Echeverry, whilst Chojnicki lost to the Dutchman Botik van der Zandschulp in round one. Next to cricket, and England have omitted Brydon Carse from their squad for the third and final test against Pakistan next week. More from Kevin Howells.
Well, Carse, the Durham seamer, was dropped from the squad ahead of the second test after he was briefly arrested following an incident outside a nightclub in Derby whilst he was away on Durham duty. He remains under investigation by Derbyshire police, who say they're looking into allegations of assault. Sonny Baker, the 23-year-old left-armer from Hampshire, who replaced Carse, has been retained in the 15-man squad, but also omitted is Matthew Fisher of Surrey. England are looking for a series clean sweep against Pakistan when they next meet next week in Birmingham.
Football, and Celtic made it 4 wins from 4 in the Scottish Premiership last night with a 3-0 home win over Aberdeen. Elsewhere, Rangers won 2-1 at Falkirk. Meanwhile, Chelsea beat Real Sociedad to seal their place in the league phase of this season's Women's Champions League alongside WSL champions Manchester City. And finally, let's hear from the England Rugby Union captain Mauro Itoje, shall we? He has told the BBC he was initially shocked when head coach Steve Borthwick rested him for England's matches against South Africa, Fiji and Argentina in July. It meant the 31-year-old was given a first proper summer break from professional rugby in more than a decade.
It took me aback a little bit. That was just something that wasn't really in my mind. I just knew that come the end of the season, we go and toured. So, yeah, I just wasn't expecting him. However, once I digested it, the more and more I thought it was the best thing for me.
And you can hear much more from Mauro Itoje in the first Rugby Union weekly pod of the new season. You can hear that podcast right now on BBC Sounds.
Mike, thank you.
I'm David Dimbleby. I've reported on America for decades.
The United States, whatever our faults may be, is the hope of the world.
America seen as the head of the free world. And yet today, that idea is in crisis.
From the History Podcast, Invisible Hands, The American Century.
The story of how the United States became a superpower at the head of a new global order. And the invisible hands that guided it.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
I'm loving that series personally. At 26 minutes to 7, you are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson at the British Museum, awaiting that unveiling of the Bayeux Tapestry, and Emma Barnett here in the studio. And now a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
BBC News has learned that criminal groups who smuggle people to the UK across the English Channel are running low on boats, which is in part leading them to use bigger, more crowded vessels. In an attempt to tackle the mega dinghies, Britain and France will today announce that 45 more French officers will be deployed on the country's beaches to stop the launches. The latest initiative to try to stop the crossings comes as Andy Burnham prepares to host the French President Emmanuel Macron at Downing Street for the first time since becoming Prime Minister. The King has described the loan of the Bayeux Tapestry to the UK as the best possible symbol of the latest bond with France. He had a private viewing of the medieval treasure along with President Macron and the Prime Minister at the British Museum last night. The Conservatives have outlined how they would raise £10 billion a year to hit the target of spending 3% of the UK's economy on defence by 2030. The party's plans include reforming housing benefit, reimposing the two-child benefit cap, and scrapping the Chagos deal. The government said Britain's defences wouldn't be funded by what it called dodgy Tory economics. Kuwait says it has intercepted a missile and drone attack from Iran, the latest flare-up in violence in the Middle East. Iranian state television said Tehran was targeting US bases in Kuwait in response to what it described as America's crimes against the Iranian people. On Tuesday night, the US and Iran carried out their biggest exchange of attacks since July. The government has named and shamed more than 600 employers who failed to pay their staff the legal minimum wage. Over an undisclosed period, some companies have underpaid workers by hundreds of thousands of pounds. People in London will be able to book a driverless robot taxi from today. There will be 15 of them in Uber's initial fleet, but they'll still have a human driver at the wheel as a safety precaution.
There you go, Jane. 24 minutes to 7. The French president may be in the UK to welcome the Bayeux Tapestry to our shores, but after sharing a laugh with the King yesterday at the British Museum, where it is, and where Nick is this morning, today Emmanuel Macron's attentions turned to more serious political matters in his first meeting with our new Prime Minister at Downing Street. In fact, the Prime Minister's first meeting with a world leader, we should say, at Downing Street since assuming the role. Henry Zeffman's here, our chief political correspondent. Henry, on the agenda, the news that UK and France are boosting police officer numbers on the French coast to try and stop what are being described as mega dinghies from launching across the English Channel.
That's right, Emma. I mean, it's an important meeting, first and foremost, because it is the new British Prime Minister meeting the French president. And that is one of the most important relationships that any British Prime Minister has, regardless of who the French president is. And of course, in 7 months or so, Andy Burnham will be dealing with a new French president. But it is also important at the moment, isn't it? Because this issue of small boats has bedeviled successive prime ministers, or rather, as they're going to discuss today, in some cases now, slightly larger boats. And as we've been hearing from James Waterhouse in the news bulletins, that is partly seen as a sign of success in disrupting the small boats trade as it was. I mean, you've seen from everything that Andy Burnham has said about small boats, including in a visit to Dover a few weeks after he became Prime Minister, that he very much wants to continue in the same vein as Sir Keir Starmer by putting greater cooperation with France and other European countries at the heart of tackling this issue. He also, of course, keeps talking about the fact that crossings were in relative terms quite low this summer, in fact at a 7-year low, but also saying that the country can't be, the government can't be complacent about this. In terms of other issues that will be on the agenda between Andy Burnham and Emmanuel Macron, we also expect them to talk about Ukraine quite extensively, as well as the situation in the Middle East. And then something that's going to be fascinating over the coming months and years in terms of what Andy Burnham's approach on this is, deepening ties between the UK and the EU more generally.
Let's go to what's been said or not been said about defence, because the Conservatives were going to be having the Shadow Defence Secretary on the programme today, talking about, about their plans for defence, that issue proving tricky for Mr Burnham yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kemi Badenoch will be talking today about how she proposes to fund her commitment, or if the Conservatives were in government, she would fund a commitment to hit defence spending of 3% of GDP by 2030. That is, of course, the acutely politically challenging figure for Andy Burnham, and more to the point, John Healey, his Chancellor, because that is what John Healey resigned as Defence Secretary over Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves refusing to do. There was, though, an interesting moment at Prime Minister's Questions yesterday, not when Kemi Badenoch asked Andy Burnham about this, but when Tan Desi Singh, the Labour chair of the Defence Select Committee, asked about this, talking about the significantly increased threat, especially from Russia. That was a real challenge for Andy Burnham. Now, there is a spread of opinion in the Labour Party on this. To wit, Diane Abbott readmitted to the Labour whip just a few weeks after Andy Burnham became Prime Minister. She said yesterday the imminent threat from Russia is a NATO fiction to justify their complete capitulation to Trump's demands for more military spending. The increase should not go ahead. And I think Tan Desi is closer to the mainstream of Labour MPs thinking on this situation generally. But these questions of defence spending are challenging, not just economically, but politically for Andy Burnham too.
We'll see what the reaction is to that particular comment from Diane Abbott, now back in the fold at Labour. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, thank you.
Time now is 20 to 7. From today, you'll be able to hail a robo-taxi in London. The cars will drive themselves, but for now at least, there will be a perhaps reassuring human at the wheel on standby. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleiman, has taken a ride and been studying the issues these taxis raise. Morning to you, Zoe. What are the challenges going to be in future for this?
So there are three main challenges, I think, facing the industry. The first one is obviously the technology itself. You know, companies like Wave, which are British tech companies, have been working on this for the best part of 10 years because they're not pre-programmed. They're taking data from what's happening around the car in real time and then using AI to process that data and come up with actions, you know, in real time on the spur of the moment as to what that car should do in response. Then you've got regulation. So here in the UK, we've got that responsibility shared between the government and the local agency. So in the case of London, Transport for London. So first of all, these companies have to get a licence from the Department for Transport, which Uber has now done. It's the first company to do that. And secondly, it then needs permission from Transport for London to operate. Otherwise, it can't charge a fare for the rides. And that is still underway. And Transport for London is still supposed to be issuing guidelines about how these companies. It's a really fierce market, by the way. Uber's come first. We've got others that really want to be part of this kind of robo-taxi market, if you like, in London. But they're still waiting for guidelines for how to apply to get that permission to do it. And the authorities are being cautious about this. You know, somebody said to me, if there's a robo-taxi doing things wrong on the road, it's not like somebody can knock on the window and have a word with them and ask to see their license. You know, once they're out there, they're out there. And so they want to get this right. And it is causing a slight delay, I think. There was the suggestion that they'd all be on the streets by the end of the year. And I think that that now is looking increasingly unlikely. And the third part of this puzzle is manufacturing. So at the moment, these cars are fitted out with tech. Uber, for example, is fitting out Wave tech into Ford Mach-E cars. But they want to have their own cars. They want to have their own bespoke cars rolling around on the streets. And somebody has to make those. And so that's in itself a massive design process. And so these companies are partnering with various other manufacturers now to try and make that happen. But again, you know, they don't exist. So there's got to be prototyping and testing. That's taking a while as well. So it's not a very quick process, is it? Sort of flooding the streets.
A few bumps in the road ahead, Zoe. Thank you for that. I'm told that one problem for these cars is that they don't understand a flash of a headlights. Does it mean come on, or does it mean stop, I'm moving? And someone I know who's made one of these journeys was stuck for quite a long time while this car tried to make its mind up.
Well, It's 17 minutes to seven. Let's move on, shall we?
Indeed, and move on to yesterday in Parliament. How long would Andy Burnham's pledge to focus on problem solving rather than point scoring survive contact with reality and his political enemies? That was the question before his first appearance at PMQs yesterday in Parliament. Our correspondent Sean Curran was watching from the press gallery in the House of Commons.
The prospect of facing a packed and noisy House of Commons can unnerve the most polished political performer. Harold Macmillan confessed PMQs left him feeling physically sick, and Tony Blair said it was the most nerve-wracking experience of his time in power. If only there was some way a new Prime Minister could prepare.
It was good to be back at this dispatch box yesterday for the first time in 16 years.
Andy Burnham spent more than 3 hours answering questions on Tuesday afternoon.
And I understand I broke records, Mr. Speaker, on my first day back for the longest statement in modern history. Thanks for your help with that, Mr. Speaker.
After all that, would anyone still have questions for the Prime Minister?
Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch. Yeah!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And can I congratulate the Prime Minister on his stamina? 3 hours. Yesterday, he faced 125 questions from MPs across the House. Of course, Labour and the Lib Dems just wanted more government spending as taxpayers' money. But can he name a single spending request to which he answered no?
Andy Burnham repeated his belief that people didn't want political point scoring.
I was quite clear in my statement about the need to get the welfare bill down. I do not want to be a Prime Minister that sees a situation where we have so many people in their 20s not in education, employment or training. I can't defend that.
Kemi Badenoch complained that the Prime Minister had avoided the question, and she challenged Andy Burnham about the state of the public finances.
The markets are clearly worried that we now have a spendthrift Prime Minister who wants to say yes to everyone but cannot tell us where the money is coming from. He needs to pay for all his new promises, and he has a choice: higher taxes, more borrowing or spending cuts. Yesterday he said change begins with honesty. So will he be honest and tell us? Is he preparing to raise taxes again, yes or no?
Like so many of his predecessors, Andy Burnham solved his PMQ's problems with a spot of point scoring as he criticised the Conservative leader's recent reshuffle.
She removed a shadow chancellor who said that the Truss mini-budget was a mistake. And she replaced that shadow chancellor with one that helped to write the Truss mini-budget.
That was a dig at the new Shadow Chancellor, Andrew Griffith, a former business executive who was a Treasury Minister in Liz Truss's government. On Tuesday, Andy Burnham said Britain had taken a series of wrong turns over the last 40 years and Brexit had compounded the economic damage. All music to the ears of the Lib Dem leader, Ed Davey.
Unless we grow the economy, there is no way we can end the cost of living crisis or cut the cost of borrowing for the government. The answer is staring him in the face. Join the single market, get a new deal with Europe, and cut costs for families, businesses and government.
The Prime Minister said he wanted a closer relationship with the European Union.
And I think he is absolutely right to share the analysis that I laid out yesterday. It's clear. The low growth we've had, the decade of low growth, has been partly a result of Brexit. And the sooner the party opposite accepts that, the more we can start to face up to Britain's future and where do we go from here.
And Andy Burnham is expected to push for greater cooperation with Europe when he holds talks with President Macron in Downing Street later this morning.
That was Sean Curran reporting from the press gallery in the Commons, telling us what was going on in Parliament. It's 12 minutes to seven. And yesterday, in some of those, you've just heard a little bit of it, but in his first PMQ since becoming Prime Minister, Andy Burnham answered a question about defence spending. He appeared to commit to 3% of GDP by 2030, but now government sources say he didn't or didn't mean to. The Conservatives, excuse me, are committing to an extra $10 billion a year, so the UK does reach that 3% by 2029/2030 or thereabouts. James Cartledge is the Shadow Defence Secretary. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Is it a row about timing? I mean, it seems to be the same commitment, the same conclusion.
I think it's actually much more simple than that. It's something which is always a big issue in politics. It's an argument about choices. You know, what are we prioritising? There have been decisions made under Keir Starmer to increase the welfare budget and not to put money into defence. We thought that would change with the new Prime Minister, especially because his Chancellor is someone who resigned over defence spending.
Well, he's not had a budget yet, has he?
Well, exactly. But the point is, John Healey resigned, saying the country needs to go to 3%. Mm. He's now Chancellor, and it's clear in his budget he is not going to use it to find that extra money. So, you know, so we've set out our plan today. It's fully funded, and we think that's leadership at a time when, it has to be said, the world is a dangerous place.
Let's come to the funding in just a moment. But, sure. You know, accusing, I suppose, of a lack of a commitment there, Andy Burnham are lacking a plan. But there is the commitment to lift defence spending to 2.7% by 2029. /30, reaching 3% in the next parliament and 3.5% by 2035 under those NATO commitments. What exactly, and you know, just adding to your point, there will be those who know, because of exactly why John Healey resigned, that under his fiscal watch, this will not go wanting. There will be a commitment and it will be met. What exactly has not been promised and what's not sufficient?
Well, it's really simple, Emma. They haven't said where they're going to get the money from. I mean, this is pretty fundamental. You can make all the promises you want. You know, we've heard for months and months they're going to go to 3%, they're going to go to 3.5%. The point is, none of that means anything unless you make the hard choices on where the money is going to come from. Are you going to put up taxes? Are you going to cut spending? Are you going to increase borrowing? And I think we saw yesterday, and to be fair, your programme covered this, there is now real anxiety in the markets about the level of borrowing. And so we think in that situation, we shouldn't be putting up taxes and hurting the economy or increasing borrowing. Our plan is about, you know, recognising that we do need to get on top of the welfare budget.
You should be taking it from welfare recipients to fund defence and war.
Principally, I mean, under the plan, welfare is the biggest part, but we are also, you know, reallocating spending from other areas. I mean, just to give you one example, you know, the government has an R&D budget. We are saying more of that should go on defence. I actually think that's not controversial given the threat environment we face.
No, but it is controversial that potentially welfare recipients should shoulder most of the burden paying for higher defence spending. It is.
I don't agree with that. I can understand why people will be unhappy with it, and I accept it's a difficult decision. But,
unhappiness and controversy can be two sides of the same thing.
Let me just finish the point, Emma. I think out in the country, the idea that our welfare budget is rising so sharply whilst defence spending is going nowhere with the threats we face is not acceptable. The first duty of government is to protect its people, defence of the realm. And we're not seeing that from Andy Burnham. We're not seeing that real leadership, which is about making those tough choices. And they are tough. You know, I'm not coming on your programme to say everyone will be happy with what we've announced. You always have, in any spending decision, winners and losers. That's what tough choices are about. And we've shown that leadership. We're in opposition. You know, this is our plan. If an election was called, we'd say, look, we are totally committed to the armed forces. We now need to see that leadership from Andy Burnham.
Do you think you'll be believed, though? Because the question also might be on those who particularly care about military and defence or work in that sector. You know, the Conservatives didn't reach 3% of GDP on defence when in government.
Hold on a minute. So the last time this country spent 3% on defence was in 1996 under a Conservative government. Tony Blair came to power, it then fell below 3%.
With the current crop of politicians, you know, very recent memory, there may be those, yep. You have to restore trust, you've talked about that,
yep.
Who wonder why they should believe that this will be the case and how you're going to actually do it.
Well, let me make two points to address that head on. First of all, Kemi and I have both repeatedly said that the threat environment has changed fundamentally, which I think everyone acknowledges, so we can't go on spending those lower levels of defence. Now, defence spending did start to increase, particularly under Boris Johnson, but it wasn't enough given the threat. And we all acknowledge that, and I think so we're open about that point. The second thing is, if you ask, you know, about trusting the Conservatives, we alone pretty much in Europe led in supporting Ukraine. We supplied them with weapons before Putin invaded. So if you say leadership on defence, we did something very special. It helped keep Ukraine in the fight, because if they'd fallen early, we'd have had a disaster that would have put Europe under threat. But that threat still exists. It's very profound. Putin, you know, is still growing his forces. He is still bombing civilians. We need to stand up to those threats, and that means taking tough choices to fund our armed forces.
Well, that will be very much on the agenda, I'm sure, with the Prime Minister in his first bilateral with Emmanuel Macron at number 10 today. James Carter, Shadow Defence Secretary. Thank you.
It is now 7 minutes to seven. 1066 is the date every school child knows. It's the nation's favourite pin code, I learned this year. And it is the year which shaped our history. A story told in exquisite beauty, with passion and with humour, in the Bayeux Tapestry, which a million people are expected to visit here at the British Museum starting next week. Rather tantalising. We're broadcasting from alongside the tapestry. But for now, and only for now, it's covered up. It will be uncovered for us, for you, at around 8 o'clock. Last night, the King accompanied President Macron for a sneak preview of its full magnificent 70 metres displayed outside France for the first time.
Well, this is my favourite bit. It's to discover, see, he brought with him an enormous cask of wine.
That's right.
For all the troops.
For the banquet before.
The President of France laughing at the idea that the French brought wine to these shores. Well, with me here, and as excited as I think as I am, is Natasha Hodgson, Associate Professor in History at Nottingham Trent. Rather more excited, I suspect, Natasha, because your life has been spent studying this tapestry and what it tells us. But for those who are a bit immune to this excitement, wonder what all the fuss is about, given that you've been able to see it pretty easily in Normandy. Why the excitement?
Oh, thanks, Nick. I'm so excited to be here, I have to say. Essentially, I think it's the fact that it's back here is really important, because it was probably made here. And so to see it back on these shores, to see, you know, possibly the work of English women that's lasted for such a long time. It's actually really rare to have material even last for such a long time. In one place, in the British Museum, it's sitting right next to me. I'm very excited.
Now, you say it was probably made here. The King joked that it could have been called the Canterbury Embroidery rather than the Bayeux Tapestry. Do we know, or is it just educated guesswork?
The Bayeux Tapestry, lots of people have theorised about it. We don't know anything necessarily for definite, but it does seem like the style of the tapestry and the way that the wording that's used does tend to suggest that it was made here in England. And also, English women were famous for their needlework across Europe.
Well, we heard the King describe his favourite bit, the wine. He probably enjoyed the coronation too, because it tells the story leading to the Battle of Hastings as well as the battle. What's your favourite bit?
Actually, it's William's ship. There's this fantastic ship as he's travelling over to Pevensey. It's called the Mora. It was bought for him by his wife, Matilda of Flanders. And it has this, if you look for it, it has this a wonderful gold cross at the top, which shows kind of church authority and that God is on his side. It also has a really unusual prow for the time, because it's in the shape of a person blowing a golden horn. And this is a child, and it's possibly meant to represent the dynasty, and Matilda of Flanders has made this ship while she's pregnant. So so there's this idea that this child on the ship represents the unborn dynasty.
Now, what's so interesting is you've highlighted one of the very few women, and there are very few, aren't there, that feature on this tapestry, almost certainly created, what, entirely by women?
It was possibly designed by a man, but it was certainly very probably sewn by women. And yes, although Matilda herself isn't on the tapestry, there are three women in the main body of the tapestry, and there are others in some of the borders. So there's a few there. There's the only one who's named, Elgifa. Unfortunately, she's still a mystery. We don't know exactly who she is. There's about a dozen theories about her. She's fantastic. We also think that the woman portrayed weeping at the death of Edward the Confessor in the tapestry is his wife, Edith.
Now, there was a lot of talk last night from the heads of state, from the Prime Minister as well, that this is a symbol not just of a past battle, but of future friendship as well. As a historian, what do you think we should take away from it?
I mean, I agree. It is a story of succession, but it's very ambiguous. You know, the fact that Harold is treated quite sympathetically throughout the tapestry again suggests possible English influence. And I think that there is this kind of sense that it is a reconciliation tapestry as well as one of conquest.
And the puzzle I found from the French I spoke to here last night, it's a much bigger deal for us than for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've had it for a really long time. So it's fantastic to see it here and for school children here who are starting their Year 7 journey with Norman Conquest to come and see it.
Natasha Hodgson of Nottingham Trent University, thank you very much indeed.
Don't know what the weather was like on different parts of the tapestry, but Chris Fawkes, how is it today in the UK?
Yes, Emma. Well, it's one of those changeable kind of days with cloud and rain to start off with for some of us, then brighter, then more rain for others. So, in detail, for England and Wales, a rather grey start to the day with some low cloud, bit of drizzle for southern areas of England, for parts of northern England, and we've got some fog patches in the southwest. So, quite a grey start for many of us, but I think the weather will quite quickly brighten up with the low cloud breaking up, spells of sunshine coming through, but it will take a while for those brighter skies to work into southern areas of England. Now, later in the day, we'll see a band of rain push into northwest England, with the rain becoming quite heavy here later in the day and moving into the far north of Wales as well. Our temperatures, 22 to 26 Celsius, feeling quite humid across southern areas. Now, for Northern Ireland, it should be a bright start here with some sunshine, clouding over towards the middle part of the day, then heavy rain moves in through the afternoon. Temperatures about 18 to 20. In Scotland, we've got some damp weather to start the day across eastern areas with some heavy rain for Orkney and Shetland. They'll tend to push northwards and eastwards over the next few hours. Then comes the spell of sunshine. Then later on this afternoon, we'll see some heavy showers work into western areas with a risk of some thunderstorms as a southwesterly wind strengthens. Temperatures here, 18 to 22 Celsius. Tomorrow, overall, it's a brighter day, a day of sunshine and showers.
Chris, thank you. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 3rd of September. Good morning if you're just joining us or still with us. The headlines today. BBC News has learned that people smugglers in France are running low on boats as the British and French government announced plans to try to stop the gangs cramming migrants into larger dinghies. We'll be having a special report from the beaches where overcrowded boats are setting off for Britain.
The boat is looking quite overloaded now. Its black sides are becoming increasingly submerged in the water. They're now trying to inch back to my right to pick up another group of people.
And the UN's World Meteorological Organization has warned that the El Nino weather pattern could last until February, increasing the risk of droughts and flooding. And B&Q is among 600 employers which have been named by the government for failing to pay some workers the national minimum wage.
Coming up in the next hour from here at the British Museum, as we prepare for the covers to be lifted from the Bayeux Tapestry, we ask what bearing a major cultural moment like this can have on our politics. I've been speaking to France's Minister for Culture.
What I would say is that culture is what remains when everything else has been forgotten. We can fight against each other, but we can find common ground on common taste, on poetry. I think that is what culture is about.
And in the next few minutes, the curator of what looks like being the biggest exhibition in a generation will tell us more about what you might be able to see. That's all after the BBC News read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
BBC News has found criminal groups who smuggle people to the UK across the English Channel are running low on boats, which is in part leading them to use bigger, more crowded vessels. In an attempt to tackle the mega dinghies, Britain and France will today announce that dozens more officers will be deployed on French beaches to stop the launches. Our Paris correspondent James Waterhouse reports from northern France.
People smugglers are frustrated and have told our sources they're having to change tactics. It's thought greater enforcement action has contributed to them running out of boats. They're instead using larger vessels, and these are departing from areas away from the Calais to Dunkirk stretch to try to avoid the French police. They're also charging the migrants more, now up to €2,000 each, and pressuring them to pay in cash instead of making money transfers. Migrants are now often having to wait months instead of weeks to successfully cross, and are often staying closer to the beach to improve their chances of making a journey.
The latest initiative to try to stop the small boat crossings comes as Andy Burnham prepares to host the French President Emmanuel Macron at Downing Street for the first time since becoming Prime Minister. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
Last night, the President and the Prime Minister admired the biotapestry on loan to the British Museum. Today, they'll focus not on historic cross-channel conflict, but contemporary cooperation. The UK and France are to boost police numbers to stop the launch of mega dinghies from the French coast. Downing Street said a surge team of 45 French officers would be deployed in the coming weeks, and that a total of more than 1,000 personnel were now involved in attempting to stop the boats. While the number of crossings was at a 7-year low this summer, the Prime Minister has said the UK can't be complacent. The Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Philp, said the government had failed to smash the gangs and that UK financial support should be withheld until the French authorities prevent all embarkations in shallow waters.
The King has described the loan of the Bayeux Tapestry as the best possible symbol of the lasting bond between the UK and France. He had a private viewing of the medieval treasure along with President Macron and Andy Burnham at the British Museum last night. The tapestry, which tells the story of the Norman conquest, goes on public display next week. Our culture editor, Katie Razzle, sent this report from the British Museum.
The King and Queen, the Prime Minister and the French President, with other dignitaries, toured the nearly 70-metre-long artwork, which is laid flat for the first time to protect it from gravity, as curators shared the stories it tells. The King spoke of the enduring bond between the two countries that began 1,000 years ago.
These 70 metres of memory and artistry remind us, therefore, that our two nations have been bound together for almost a millennium. The moments depicted in the tapestry echo into our own days.
The loan of the fragile medieval treasure was pushed through by President Macron against some vocal opposition. He told assembled guests the tapestry was a reminder of what France and Britain could do when the two nations stood together.
The Conservatives have outlined how they would raise £10 billion a year to hit the target of spending 3% of the UK's economy on defence by 2030. They say the funds would come from a series of measures, including reforming housing benefit, reimposing the two-child benefit cap and scrapping the Chagos deal. The government said Britain's defences wouldn't be funded by what it called dodgy Tory economics. The UN's World Meteorological Organization has warned the current El Niño weather pattern could last until at least February. The phenomenon causes surface temperatures to rise in the Pacific Ocean, increasing the risk of droughts and floods in different parts of the world. The Met Office has already warned that this year's El Niño could be the strongest in living memory, possibly leading to more wet and stormy weather in the UK this autumn and winter. Our climate reporter Mark Poynting has more.
In today's report, UN scientists say they're nearly 100% certain that El Niño will continue until at least February, the surest they've ever been. Sea temperatures in a key area of the Pacific are already rivaling some of the highest ever observed there, months before El Niño's expected peak around Christmas. If the forecasts play out, scientists say they expect unusually dry weather in large areas of Southeast Asia, Central America and the Amazon in the next few months, raising the risk of droughts, while parts of eastern Africa, southern Brazil and the southern US could face wetter conditions, increasing the chances of flooding.
Kuwait says it has intercepted a missile and drone attack from Iran, the latest flare-up in violence in the Middle East. Iranian state television said Tehran was targeting US bases in Kuwait in response to what it described as America's crimes against the Iranian people. On Tuesday night, the US and Iran carried out their biggest exchange of attacks since July, with Tehran claiming that a wedding in the south of the country was hit. The Pentagon insists it doesn't target civilians. The government has named and shamed more than 600 employers who failed to pay their staff the legal minimum wage. Over an undisclosed period, some companies have underpaid workers by hundreds of thousands of pounds. The business secretary, Jonathan Reynolds, said the government would stamp out the practice of shortchanging staff. Here's our business reporter, Ema Moreau.
Today's list from the Department for Business and Trade includes several NHS trusts, nursing homes and other social care providers, and childcare businesses. In total, £4 million in wages has been repaid to more than 27,000 workers following enforcement action. The employers named have also been issued penalties totalling £7 million. But the DIY chain B&Q owed the most, having failed to pay more than £450,000 to over 4,000 workers. The company said the shortfalls were unintentional and staff were paid what they were owed in July last year.
Tens of thousands of people have demonstrated in Madrid against the Spanish government's handling of the migrant crisis in the North African city of Ceuta. In July, more than 70,000 migrants briefly crossed from Morocco. The protesters called for the socialist Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, to quit, accusing him of being too slow to restore order and return migrants. The government says it must follow legal procedures when deporting people. President Trump has said he's happy that Prince Harry and his wife Meghan have left the United States and moved back to the UK. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex returned last week with their two children, 6 years after they stepped back from royal duties and relocated to California. Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office, Mr. Trump said he wasn't a fan of how the couple acted.
I thought they treated the royal family with great disrespect. I didn't like it. I didn't like the way she acted. I thought she was terribly disrespectful to the Queen, to King Charles, and I don't know, maybe I'm different. I wouldn't have taken him back.
People in London will be able to book a driverless robot taxi from today. There will be 15 of them in Uber's initial fleet, but they will still have a human driver at the wheel as a safety precaution. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman has been for a ride.
My Robo Taxi took most of the challenges found on London streets in its stride. Roadworks, a protest outside Parliament, and even some emphatic hand gestures from a cyclist. But the Uber safety driver did choose to intervene in a tight spot with a parked van and a swinging door. Originally, it was hoped that a large number of self-driving rides might be operating in the capital by Christmas. That's looking increasingly unlikely. Regulators have faced criticism for being slow, but they say it's important to get this right.
Zoe Kleinman reporting.
Jane, thank you. It's 9 minutes past seven. We're set to have potentially one of the strongest El Niño events on record this autumn, with impacts almost 100% likely to persist through till February of next year. El Niño is a naturally occurring weather pattern, which happens about every 2 to 7 years, lasting for around a year. The powerful natural climate phenomenon pushes up global temperatures and can increase the risks of extreme weather. Now the World Meteorological Organization is warning this one will strengthen into a very strong event. But what does that mean? Professor Celeste Saulo, who's the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
What makes this El Niño different from previous strong ones?
Well, certainly it's exceptional is the amount of heat built up in the Pacific Ocean, the levels that could exceed anything recorded since comparable satellite measurements began, over 40 years ago. And this is massive amounts of energy that will be available for the atmospheric circulation to translate into rainfall, as you already mentioned, droughts and heat waves all around the world.
And I suppose if you've heard warnings like this before, you know, you might not understand quite what to do with this information. I mean, is there anything we should be doing, just ordinary people?
Well, certainly governments are at the front line, you know, because there are certain measures that are beyond the individuals. And when you spoke about areas that will be likely be more affected by even by droughts or floods, you need to have the all the relevant stakeholders to make sure that they prepare in advance. Let's put an example. If you expect droughts, you can prepare in advance and plant seeds that are resistant to droughts. If you expect floods, you can do exactly the opposite. But these are decisions that it's not for an individual to take. But what I would like to just emphasize is that because we live in a globalized world with a globalized economy, this El Niño will affect the food that you take every day, the water you have access to, and the prices you pay for everything. And that is why we are just not only warning, but calling to action in advance.
Yes, and I suppose, I mean, that comes to, you know, the roles in our governments where they are responsible for disaster planning, for you know, preempting such situations. When you talk about this El Nino and other El Ninos, you know, it's always described as a natural phenomenon not caused by climate change. Are there any links?
Yes, of course, there are always layers, but certainly you've been very precise. El Niño is a natural climate variability phenomenon, and it you can have an El Niño every 2 to 7 years. But what we cannot disconnect the El Niño from is the global trend. And the global trend shows that the last 11 years were the warmest on record. So if we expect warming 2026 and 2027, that will happen on top of what is already the trend. So that's why we can expect records to be exceeded in 2026 or 2027.
And where are the parts of the world that you're most concerned about? Have you highlighted that?
Well, usually, the most vulnerable countries are the most exposed because of the lack of time to prepare and the lack of, I would say, facilities to put in place. But as mentioned before, certainly we expect droughts in many areas of Australia and Southeast Asia, also a weakened monsoon in India, below normal rains in Southern Africa and also in Central and Northern South America. That means that there are several areas that will be affected by less rainfall. And on the other hand, we expect exceeding rainfall in parts of China and parts of Japan and parts of the Horn of Africa and in Southern South America. So yes, it's about how you combine all of these anomalies into something that you can prepare for and make sure that the impacts are as controlled as possible.
As controlled, yes, indeed. Professor Celeste Saulo, thank you.
It's now 7:15. It is rather tantalising to be broadcasting this morning alongside the Bayeux Tapestry here at the British Museum outside France for the first time. Tantalising because it's going to be undercover for another hour or so. I've yet to see it in its new home. And a group of schoolchildren from Hastings, and with a little help from me, will tell you what to make of it in an hour's time, if you're not one of the lucky million or so estimated to attend what looks like being the exhibition of a generation. But I'm joined here at the British Museum by someone who's not just seen it, but he's studied it for 30 years and been intimately involved in the decisions about moving it here temporarily to London. Michael Lewis joins us. He's the lead curator of the Bayeux Tapestry exhibition. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
For you of all people, can you believe you're here? It's here at last.
I know, it's incredible, isn't it? We're right next to it. And we're almost near the place where Harold gets the arrow in the eye as well, as we're alongside the tapestry. So, a fantastic thing. Fantastic moment that the tapestry is finally now in the UK, ready for a British public to see.
Yeah, and that has taken many years and extraordinary logistical efforts. Amidst warnings from some in France, it was just too risky to do.
That's right. I mean, in 2013, I joined the Bayeux Tapestry Scientific Committee, where we're looking at advising Bayeux Museum in how to redisplay the tapestry there. And it's very clear that actually they needed a new museum to do this effectively, and therefore the tapestry was going to have to be moved.
Redisplay, crucial word, because it was on the wall, and it was in a kind of U shape, wasn't it? And here it is, flat, 70 metres long in this enormous gallery.
Yeah, that's right. It's a U shape in Bayeux, and now it's flat. That's a requirement of the French state, but it does allow us...
A requirement, forgive me, because it might be damaged if
it's
hung.
So it was kind of fairly clear in Bayeux, really, that the tapestry was potentially being damaged because of the curve at the end and because it was hanging directly, a bit like a curtain, really. So it was a directive from the French state that here, for this exhibition, it's going to be flat. But that does allow us, for the first time, to show the tapestry in a continuous length. which hasn't been the case for many years. In fact, probably since the 1700s, when it was sort of rolled out for people to see. So, it's a significant thing that we can do that. And also, because of the display case that we've got, you can get really, really close to the tapestry, quite unlike you could in Bayeux, in a way.
Yes, we saw the king. We heard him earlier on the programme enthusing about the wine that was being brought and the ships across. Yes. Have you got a favourite moment, place on the tapestry?
Yeah, my favourite scene is the moment where Edward the Confessor dies, because he's shown touching hands with Harold. And we know from a record of the time that it might have been the time when he basically was promised by Edward that he could, you know, look after the kingdom. And he obviously overinterpreted that and said, yeah, I'm gonna be king next.
Yeah. Now, there's been all that controversy, of course, about the arrow in the eye.
Yes.
Can you settle it? Was it originally put in by the embroiderers, or do we think it was added later?
Well, it was certainly added later in terms of what we have now. So the tapestry has been heavily restored in the 19th century, and that arrow in the eye has definitely been added. The question is, was it ever there in the first place? And scholars are a bit divided about whether that figure with the arrow in the eye or the one that's kind of been chopped down are Harold. So some people say it's, you know, both the things are happening. The problem with the arrow in the eye story is it comes around in the 13th century. So some people, you know, myself included, probably think that originally Harold probably never had an arrow in his eye at all.
So there must be some people, you meet them for a coffee, you meet them for a pint, and they go, 30 years studying the Bayeux tapestry. Get a life, Michael. Why is it worth our study? What is it that you hope the country will get, and so many of us will get the chance to see it, that you've obviously relished, you've loved over these decades?
Yeah, I mean, obviously 1066 is a moment in our history, a pivotal moment in our history, and the Bayeux tapestry is the first narrative of that event. And so I think most people, when they see the tapestry, they're going to be amazed by both its length, but the preservation of that object. When you look at things from the 11th century, particularly textiles, they're very, very fragmentary. And, you know, the tapestry is not that. So I think people are just going to be overwhelmed by the detail and the fact that it brings that period of the, you know, the 11th century to life.
Last thought, we were told very clearly, you can't bring your coffee and tea in here, no wonder, really. Do you know quite what the indemnity is? How valuable is this object if someone were to do it damage?
Well, there's a government indemnity against it, but actually, I mean, obviously, this object is hard to value in any sort of way. Obviously, it'd be a tragic loss if it ever was damaged, but obviously, we're going to do our best to care for it at the British Museum.
I think the taxpayers written off about 800 million quid just in case someone were to bring their coffee. But of course, it's in a beautiful glass case, specially built for the purpose, with the help of people like Michael. Michael Lewis, congratulations to you and your team of curators here at the Bayeux Tapestry Exhibition.
Thank you very much.
It's 20 past seven. Government borrowing costs have jumped this week, as have some of the interest rates that impact the cost of a mortgage, which is what you may be thinking about. Sean Farrington has more. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Emma. So for fixed rate mortgages, lenders will often go off another measure of rates called swap rates, and they've also increased in recent days, some of them to the highest level they've seen for 3 years. I've got Tom Simpson with me, who's Managing Director of Homes at Yorkshire Building Society. He's provided nearly 40,000 new residential mortgages last year. Tom, good morning. Would you be expecting mortgage rates to rise in the coming days?
So what we see is those geopolitical factors are having an impact. Specifically, what we've seen is that those swap rates you mentioned have moved by about 0.1% over the last week. But we need to set that into context. The swap rates are high, but they are 0.7% above where they were a year ago. But we saw much more volatility in March. So over a 10-day period, they change by about 0.5%. So, you know, those factors can push rates up or down, but all things being equal, you would expect a modest increase in mortgage rates based on what we've seen so far. And I think the thing I'd say to any of your listeners is the best thing they could do is speak to an independent mortgage advisor to understand what's right for them.
And when you see a, you know, relatively sudden move like this, may not be of the scale back in March, but the move that we've seen in recent days, does that impact how customers behave? Are there how lenders behave? Is there a bit of a flurry to get rid of deals that were on the market before because they're out of date now?
We do see that. So when you think about swap rates, and you touched on fixed rate mortgages there, they're really a way of lenders fixing their funding costs to provide fixed rate mortgages. And lenders do that in advance. And so what you do see at times from borrowers and brokers is that when there is a movement in the market, that can pull forward demand. People will try and lock those rates in. But as I've said, in this situation, a 0.1 increase, which is what we've seen over the last week, is much less of an increase than when we saw a 0.5 increase in 10 days when the war in Iran broke out.
Tom, thank you. Tom Simpson there from Yorkshire Building Society.
And thank you, Sean. It's 22 minutes past seven. Alongside war in the Middle East and Ukraine, the crisis in the Channel will be at the top of the agenda for the Prime Minister's talks with President Macron at Downing Street this morning. The leaders will no doubt congratulate themselves at the number of crossings being currently at a six-year low, thanks, both sides argue, to French police intercepting more attempts. The BBC, though, has been told that criminal groups who illegally smuggle people to the UK across the English Channel are running low on small boats. Gang members say that rival factions are now having to work together to load migrants onto fewer, larger vessels. They're also charging them more. The number of crossings is currently at that six-year low. UK ministers have been crediting the French police for intercepting more attempts. Here's the BBC's Paris correspondent, James Waterhouse, who's been looking at how the people smugglers are being forced to adapt.
The sense we're getting is that officers have become more efficient in preventing launches, but that hasn't quashed the desires of migrants still wanting to make this journey and the motivations of the gangs looking to help them across this dangerous waterway. During a low morning tide on the deep beach at Gravelin near Dunkirk, a group of a dozen or so migrants emerge from the dunes and walk, not run, towards the warm shallows of the English Channel. A taxi boat, a small boat that's departed from Belgium, then approaches them, as do we.
Where are you from?
Afghanistan.
Afghanistan. Why are you going to the UK? Why UK? Why not go legally? Why do it like this? It's very dangerous.
The boat is looking quite overloaded now. Its black sides are becoming increasingly submerged in the water. They're now trying to inch back to my right to pick up another group of people.
Good morning. Where are you from?
Afghanistan.
Afghanistan. Are you waiting for another boat?
No.
Was that the boat you were hoping?
Yeah.
Is it going to come back for you?
We don't know.
You don't know?
Yeah, we don't know nothing. No.
Why are you making such a dangerous journey?
Punjabi.
Yeah, Punjabi. What do you want to do in the UK? Work? I mean, we know a few of the guys speak English. I think they're choosing not to engage.
And if you pan along the beach, you can see the shoreline scramble. There are NGOs, humanitarian groups who have rushed here, where there are police looking on. Officers here argue they are prevented from intervening once boats are in the water over fears of people drowning, but claim they're now intercepting two-thirds of them before that point. Although British officials have long been frustrated with this French reluctance and would like their neighbours to at least adopt a more case-by-case approach.
The belief from people you speak to in the camps is that they want to get a job, they want to get employment, and they want to apply for asylum and get it. They want the means to work and live. And I think that is one of the big pulls for the UK, but also a shared language and also people already having friends and family in the UK.
After 3 hours, five collections and zero police interventions, the small boat ventures out into the world's busiest shipping lane. All 82 people on board make it to the UK. But the people smugglers are frustrated. Some have told our sources that they're running low on boats. At the largest migrant camp further up coast, it's emptier. More people are staying closer to the beach to boost their chances of crossing, which means, according to charity worker Angel Vettorello, they can't access humanitarian aid.
I don't think that people are understanding what is really happening here, which means hundreds of families of children living outside, far away from help from the state, facing dangers, obviously from the gangs, but also from the police. And what they want is to cross to find a new life.
We've been to the camp on several occasions, but this time
there was a perceptible unease. That discomfort would turn into confrontation when one gang member started repeatedly throwing rocks at us from close range. We got away sharpish in the car.
We've just had to drive to the hospital because Paul, our cameraman, got hit by a rock. There was a man who was in what looked like a new tracksuit. We think he was one of the smugglers who didn't like us having a camera. Paul got hit just above his eyebrow. It's left quite a nasty dent.
Paul would end up having stitches, but we left northern France in no doubt of the still strong motivations to reach the UK illegally. And for the people smuggling gangs, that still means money and a need to evolve.
James Waterhouse reporting. It's now 28 minutes past seven and Mike's here with the sport.
Nick, thank you. Good morning. Not many Brits left at the US Open singles after defeat for Jacob Fernley and Jan Chointsky yesterday, alongside Katie Bolter as well, who is also out. The British number one was blown away by the Wimbledon finalist Karolina Mukova inside just 58 minutes. Fran Jones, though, is through to the second round in New York for the very first time in her career. She plays later today, as does Harriet Dartz. We'll have more tennis chat in the next hour when we'll be joined by the four-time US Open wheelchair champion Alfie Hewitt. But now let's talk football, shall we, and get an early temperature check on the Scottish Premiership season. BBC Scotland's Kenny Crawford joins us. Hi, Kenny.
Good morning, Mike.
You were watching Celtic last night, weren't you? All the talk this time last week was of Martin O'Neill's side blowing that 4-0 aggregate lead in the Champions League to fall out of that top-tier European competition. Back to winning ways last night, though.
Yeah, there's no doubt there's a lot of disappointment still about that defeat to LASK, because the Champions League is where they want to be, and they failed against the Austrians. But domestically, it looks like Celtic are going to be the strong force, Mike, that they so often are. Last night, a straightforward 3-0 win against Aberdeen, who are poor, to be fair. And I think one of the stories to watch with Celtic this season is the emergence of this striker, Camilo Duran, signed for $5 million from Karabag of Azerbaijan. He's already got 6 goals so far this season. 3 of his goals have been absolute beauties from outside the box. Last night, kissed the underside of the crossbar on its way in, and for £5 million, that looks to be a great bit of business. And they've got St Mirren on Saturday night, Mike, who St Mirren have emerged as the second place side so far with 10 points from 12. So Saturday night should be a really interesting fixture in Paisley between St Mirren and Celtic.
Elsewhere, much needed win last night for Rangers and their new manager, Derek McInnes.
Yeah, there was a lot of pressure building on Derek McInnes, who came from Hearts, of course. But in the last couple of games, they've picked up 6 points from 6, a 1-0 win away to Aberdeen on Sunday, and then beating Falkirk 2-1 last night. And scorer of all 3 goals in those games for Rangers was Lauren Shankland, who they signed from Hearts and made captain at Ibrox. And he scored 3 really good goals, one from the penalty spot as well, right in the top corner. And that's the confidence that they want him to have, because they know that when he's firing with confidence, that he'll hit the back of the net, and Derek McInnes will be absolutely delighted to see him scoring and Rangers starting to build up a little bit more resilience. They've got 7 points from 12 so far.
And just finally, Kenny, briefly, you mentioned Hearts a few times there. They play Hibs, don't they, this evening in the Edinburgh Derby. Are Hearts fans truly over what happened to them in May, of course, when they came, what, just 5 minutes away from winning their first Scottish League title in over 60 years? Have they fully got over that?
It was definitely a slow start to the season. They were almost mourning the loss of Derek McInnes and Lauren Shankland and their midfielder Cammy Devlin as well. All of them went to Rangers. Hearts got a new Belgian manager called Wouter Vranken, and it was a slow start for him. They lost a couple of European qualifiers, but then it started slowly to build. They beat Rapid Vienna to get into the Conference League, and that's built a lot of confidence, and they've had good league wins against Dundee United and St Johnston as well. So people are starting to think that Vranken is maybe not just an equal replacement to McInnes, but could be better than him in terms of guiding Hearts to a good finish in the league this season. They're currently sixth with 6 points from 3 games, and Hibs have also got 6 points from 3 games. So it's going to be a really interesting clash at Easter Road tonight. Interestingly, Hearts won last time they visited there at the end of last season, so Hibs will feel like they've got a score to settle.
Yeah, that new manager will certainly endear himself if he wins his first Edinburgh derby later this evening. Many thanks for that. That is BBC Scotland's Kenny Crawford.
Mike, thank you. We'll speak to you again shortly. Let me tell you, at 28 minutes to 8, it is Norman Day across BBC Radio 4 today. Tim Hardford and the More or Less team are also getting involved, interrogating, as you would expect, some of the statistics behind the Norman invasion, including how big were the armies that confronted each other in 1066?
Norman Day on BBC Radio 4.
How many soldiers fought at the Battle of Hastings? One medieval chronicler claimed Harold commanded 1.2 million men, while William brought a measly 150,000. Those numbers are medieval nonsense, exaggerated for religious effect. The truth is, we don't know exactly how many men fought, but we can make a pretty good estimate by looking at the geography of the battlefield, Harold's army call-up system, and how many troops William could actually fit into his ships. The scholarly consensus is that William had around 6,000 to 8,000 soldiers, with Harold commanding a similar number. That made Hastings a huge battle for its time, but compared with more recent wars, it was tiny, roughly a tenth of Waterloo.
Thank you. And looking forward to that. Coming up, from the battles of the past to the politics of the present, we'll discuss the significance of the Bayeux Tapestry being unveiled here in London at the British Museum with the French Culture Minister, Catherine Pégard, and with the UK Government Envoy for the Bayeux Tapestry Loan, the former British Ambassador to Paris, Lord Ricketts.
Also going to be hearing why the Vice President of America thinks the Antichrist might be amongst us. On that light note, let me tell you, you're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Emma Barnett. It's 27 minutes to 8. And now a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
BBC News has learned that criminal groups who smuggle people to the UK across the English Channel are running low on boats, which is in part leading them to use bigger, more crowded vessels. In an attempt to tackle the mega dinghies, Britain and France will today announce that 45 more French officers will be deployed on the country's beaches to stop the launches. The initiative comes as Andy Burnham prepares to host the French President Emmanuel Macron at Downing Street for the first time since becoming Prime Minister. The King has described the loan of the Bayeux Tapestry to the UK as the best possible symbol of the lasting bond with France. He had a private viewing of the medieval treasure along with President Macron and the Prime Minister at the British Museum last night. The Conservatives have outlined how they would raise £10 billion a year to hit the target of spending 3% of the UK's economy on defence by 2030. The party's plans include reforming housing benefit, reimposing the two-child benefit cap, and scrapping the Chagos deal. The government said Britain's defences wouldn't be funded by what it called dodgy Tory economics. The UN's World Meteorological Organization has warned the current El Niño weather pattern could last until at least February. The phenomenon causes surface temperatures to rise in the Pacific Ocean, increasing the risk of droughts and floods in different parts of the world. Sea temperatures in a key area of the Pacific have already reached some of the highest ever observed, months before El Niño's expected peak around Christmas. The government has named and shamed more than 600 employers who failed to pay their staff the legal minimum wage. Over an undisclosed period, some companies have underpaid workers by hundreds of thousands of pounds. The BepiColombo mission to explore Mercury will begin its arrival at the planet today, 8 years after its launch. Two unmanned probes will separate from the module that carried them there and will eventually orbit the rocky world which is closest to the sun.
Jane, thank you. It's 25 minutes to 8. The lights have just gone out here at the British Museum. We're broadcasting in almost total darkness because the curators of the Bayeux Tapestry exhibition here are preparing to pull back the covers on the remarkable glass cases built specially for the purpose of displaying this tapestry for the first time outside France, as never before, flat in its full 70-metre glory. President Macron persisted with his decision to loan the tapestry to Britain. It's taken 8 years, and he joked last night, quite a lot of patience. Why? Because he was warned by some back at home in France. It was not safe. It was a heritage crime to risk moving an artwork which had somehow escaped all the risks, mould, moths, fire, theft, vandalism, you name it, and done it for almost 1,000 years. Now, alongside him for much of that decision-making time has been his culture minister, advisor, a veteran political journalist, Catherine Pégard. I spoke to her here at the British Museum yesterday. She was kind enough to speak to us at first in English and then said she preferred to use a translator. I began by asking her how she feels now that the tapestry is finally here safely.
I think it's an extraordinary partnership to reflect the friendship between British and French. And I think it's especially important for people who lived in Normandy like me, because I was born in Normandy. So it's the Minister of Culture, of course, but it's also the woman from Normandy. And discovering this tapestry here in London, especially the enthusiasm of British people to have this tapestry here.
Why did President Macron take the risk? You know that back at home, some said it is too dangerous for the tapestry to move. Some people said that it was a form of cultural vandalism. Why did he do it?
No, I think today we must forget all of this, because I think President Macron was right. It was not foolish to ask this tapestry coming to London, because we have all the experts, all the scientists, all the curators, all the historians to make it possible.
What does it represent then for our two countries, this loan?
Je peux continuer en français? Je pense que pour nos
I think that for both our countries, it is not only political stakes, it's also diplomatic and cultural stakes, but it's also something between us, between peoples, between the French people and the British people. It represents a very long friendship that went through history with ups and downs. But I think that the French and the British have such a long common history, which is shown by this tapestry, that this embroidery is, in effect, something that illustrates our common history. And I think it is very important for us both.
The president joked that it took even longer than negotiating Brexit to negotiate the loan of the tapestry. And he said that when we come together, everything is possible. Does this moment give you hope of closer relationships between Britain and France?
Bien évidemment, parce que
yes, of course, because we have always demonstrated, and I think President Macron has always shown that in the difficult moments, we always come together. We have gone through difficult moments with Brexit recently, but today I think there is a willingness to get over these difficulties, and I think that together we can build a common future, because I think the young people here in Britain will discover their own history in this wonderful cartoon that they will be able to see in the next few days. And for us French, it is also a way to better understand a very special link that unites us with the UK.
Entre la France et l'Angleterre.
You are the Minister for Culture. Sometimes in English we talk of culture wars. How important is culture for reducing the differences between people, political divisions in our society?
What I would say is that culture is what remains when everything else has been forgotten. We can fight against each other, but we can find common ground on common taste, on poetry, on a concert. I think that is what culture is about. It's a universe that we share, environment that changes us. Culture is something that helps us to get over our differences.
The president will be the first foreign leader to visit Prime Minister Burnham in 10 Downing Street. They have an important agenda, Ukraine and Iran. But inevitably, British minds are also on the Channel, on the small boats. Does it frustrate you, the extent to which that issue seems to dominate relations?
Of course. We feel that it is a pity that there is so much misery in the world, and we are living through difficult times.
Where
there is more marked differences, more marked violence, speech is more radicalized, and I think that today it shows that even if we live in a difficult environment with chaos and difficulties on both sides of the channel, today and tonight we are meeting with an agenda and some event that is much greater than any of that. The tapestry can bring us together and show us that there is a future, there is a hope that gives us a possibility to carry on writing this history. What is important to me is to add further sections to this linen tapestry and make sure that this history can carry on between us, whatever the difficulties we've been through.
Before you were culture minister, you did my job for 30 years. You were a political journalist.
It is easier to ask questions than to answer questions.
We share something else in Britain and France. The rise of the populist right. For you, it's the National Rally. Mm-hmm. In this country, Reform UK, Restore Britain. Is culture part of the answer for dealing with those sorts of challenges?
Bien sûr, je crois que la culture doit
être. Yes, of course. I think that culture needs to be at the forefront to be able to give a response to any radical speech, any violence. And this is what this is all about. We are answering extremists and extremes. And I think that we need to be conscious of that in Britain and in France. We have a common culture, and because of that, we defend this common culture, and this is how we will be able to fend off the extremes.
Is it a very nervous time for you, moving the tapestry, moving it back? Has it been a time when you stay awake at night thinking, have we done the right thing? What could be the result?
You speak about my night or the nightmare during the night thinking of the tapestry. I think the first relief was when we knew that the tapestry was arrived. And I received a text telling it is in front of the British Museum. And I think at this time, I thought we did it.
And now you just hope it gets back okay.
Yes, but it will come back the same way with the same teams, with the same people. No, I am quite for the future.
Thank you for Hopefully. The loan. We look forward to seeing it. Minister of Culture, Catherine Pegard, thank you very much indeed. And listening to that, and here with me in the darkness as we wait to see the tapestry unveiled, Lord Ricketts, Peter Ricketts, the UK government envoy for the Bayer Tapestry Loan, as well as the former British ambassador to France in the years leading up to the crucial decision up till 2016. Good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning, Nick.
She talked about it in political terms. For some, this exhibition is about history. It's about what she calls charmingly a wonderful cartoon. But you, as a former diplomat, as a policymaker, do you think it has a value beyond that?
Yes, I think cultural diplomacy is very important. What it can do is bring nations and people together, and it can change the context. So last night, the politicians were here together, not talking about the difficult day-to-day political issues, but this shared history between our countries, how we can come together, how we can inspire children to think about history. And so when the Prime Minister and the President meet later on today, the background will be an inspiring, uplifting evening, reminding us all that we are two old nations that have been through an enormous amount. And that's part of the power of cultural diplomacy.
The warmth, the personal connection matters. It makes a difference, you think?
It has to make a difference. I mean, now we've had, Emmanuel Macron's had six British Prime Ministers. This won't just be an ordinary meeting tomorrow, this morning. It's going to be a moment where they've shared something very special. I think you were there last night. We all felt this was an amazing moment to have this extraordinary object we can't yet see, 950 years old, back in this country. That changes the way we are talking about UK-French relations, and we need to build on that.
And yet, you may have seen the front page of the Sun today. One in the eye for Andy, it says, with a cartoon of the Bayer tapestry, and say as the small boats keep coming, France offers just 45 more at what it calls do-nothing cops. So somebody's saying, well, forget all this. Why don't the French just stop the boats?
Well, as I say, this helps to change the context for the conversation. It doesn't, of course, change the substance. I've worked with the French for 15 years now on this issue of the small boats. Before that, the jumping on lorries, as it was a decade ago. The French are doing an enormous amount. Let's not miss that. And the fact that there are now fewer boats available for the traffickers to use shows that we're succeeding in the work upstream to get at the traffickers, at the supply of boats. When you get to the beaches, it's the most difficult problem to deal with. But the French are, in good faith, doing everything they can to help us, I'm quite sure.
And in good faith, will the French let Britain get closer to the EU, as the new Prime Minister wants and Keir Starmer wanted? Or will they be the one using that famous phrase we heard so often from Michel Barnier, say, no cherry-picking, he used to say?
Well, it's all actually been about cherry-picking. The great agreement between the UK and the EU was cherry-picking. What we won't be able to do is get closer to them if we maintain the red lines, because that draws a limit to how far they'll be prepared to go.
Let's end with why we're here. What's your favourite moment on this wonderful tapestry I'm looking forward to seeing in half an hour's time?
Right in the middle of the tapestry, there is a crucial moment where the tapestry gets diplomatic. It's a scene where Harold, before the battle, is in Bayeux with Duke William, and he's reaching out in a very awkward gesture between two reliquaries. And the tapestry says, here, Harold swears a sacred oath to Duke William. It doesn't say what the oath is. If it was that he was going to support William for the crown, support Harold for the crown, then Harold is a perjurer, and he's got his legal base for the invasion. If not, not. The tapestry is silent.
A diplomat's view. We'll hear other views later in the programme. Peter Ricketts, Lord Ricketts, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
12 minutes to 8. It is time now for Thought for the Day, and the speaker this morning, the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells, Vicar of St. Martin in the Fields.
Good morning. The Prime Minister made his first statement in the Commons on Tuesday, discussing issues he sees as crucial to the nation's revival. But if he's anything like his three immediate predecessors, he'll be judged on one thing above all. As Bill Clinton's staff like to say, it's the economy, stupid. On Monday, at the age of 92, the world lost one of America's most distinctive voices, the agrarian poet, novelist and essayist, Wendell Berry. In his defining 1984 essay, The Two Economies, Berry describes the little economy, which only includes certain people, only buys certain things, only lasts a limited length of time. It's the world in which there's not enough to go round. It's the economy of scarcity. By contrast, there's the great economy. The great economy is for everybody, gives what money can't buy and never expires. This is the economy of abundance. It's the currency of heaven. Berry says while a little economy can evaluate, distribute, use and preserve things, it cannot make value. Value can originate only in the great economy. The secret of happiness is learning to love the things we have in plenty and don't run out. The name for those things is the great economy. Berry's essay offers us a clue to unlock one of Jesus' most impenetrable parables, the story of the shrewd manager. A wealthy man fires his manager. The manager has a few days before he has to leave. He decides to visit his boss's debtors and reduce their debts. To everyone's surprise, the rich man commends the manager, saying in as many words, "You were in a hole and you got out of it. You realize generosity is the best investment. You're better at this than I am." The notion of economics is rooted in the Greek word for household management. Economics means putting your house in order. In the parable, the manager loses his own home but ends up being welcomed into everyone else's. It's too late to make money, but it's not too late to build social capital. The manager switches economies. He gives up trying to squeeze people for a living and starts making friends instead. He realizes, however desperate his financial plight, the friends are more important than the money. He moves from an economy of scarcity and perpetual anxiety to an economy of abundance and limitless grace. Wendell Berry's greatest legacy was not his searing words, but his peerless example. In 1964, aged 30, he bought a farm in his native Kentucky, which he tended for the next 60 years. Everything he wrote, he tested against the truth of this landscape. His prophetic life asks us which economy we're really living in.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells, Vicar of St. Martin in the Fields. 9 minutes to eight. The Vice President of America wouldn't feel shocked if the Antichrist was walking among us or if the world was already in end times. J.D. Vance, a committed Catholic, made these comments on the podcast of 22-year-old Bryce Crawford. That podcast explores conversations on Christ and major topics concerning Christianity and the world. Here's what Bryce asked him.
You're the vice president of the United States.
Yeah.
You know a lot that's going on, more than people do. What do you think about the end times? Do you think that we're here? Do you think it's coming?
My view on it is, so one, do I think that we're in the end times? I don't know. And I think that it's probably bad for me spiritually to focus too much on it, because there are like things you got to do. I got to be good to my wife. I got to be good to my kids. I have to be as good of a leader as I can for the United States of America. While I'm fascinated by it, I think focusing on it too much can be very bad. I think that there are like things about the world that make me feel like not shocked if the Antichrist was walking among us. And one of the things that I think that Catholics are very focused on, that I think is very good for me, is this idea we don't know when God is coming, but we are commanded to try to, as much as possible, try to make the world the kind of world that God wants it to be. What I'm trying to focus on is doing as much of God's work as possible right now. And if that leads to the end times, okay. And if that leads to us building a better world that thrives and survives for a very long time after I'm gone, that's great too.
Rod Dreher, that was J.D. Vance, I should remind you. Rod Dreher is a conservative writer and columnist at the Free Press in New York, and a friend of J.D. Vance. He was there when Mr. Vance was received into the Catholic Church in 2019 and is familiar with his thinking. He's also the author of Living in Wonder, which is a book about modern re-enchantment. I spoke to him a little earlier about the impact of Mr. Vance's words and what exactly the Vice President means by the Antichrist.
The Antichrist is a figure who will be all-powerful at the end of time, will control the entire world, will persecute Christians, and will only be stopped by the return of Jesus Christ. Now, this might sound bonkers to someone who is outside the Christian religion, but it's very, very common belief within Christianity. And I think what J.D. meant is simply saying that the world seems to be going so crazy today that it is possible to imagine that we are living in the end times.
I suppose it's just trying to understand, in his position and that position he has with all that power and influence, that it gives a lens into how he's thinking about how bad the state of the world is.
Yeah, but you know, I know J.D. is a Catholic. In fact, we've been friends for years. He invited me to be there, be present when he was received into the Catholic Church in 2019. And he takes his faith seriously. Any serious Christian has to see what's happening in the world with the rise of wars, with AI and the seeming breakdown of society. One does have to wonder. But one thing that gave me a lot of assurance is he made the point at least twice that, yeah, he thinks about this stuff, but he doesn't focus on it because he thinks it would be harmful and a diversion from doing his daily work. And I think that's a sensible, prudent way to see things.
How does it fit into MAGA culture? How does that intersect?
Well, I think a lot of MAGA culture is very evangelical Protestant, and the whole end times Antichrist discourse is much more prominent within evangelical circles than in Catholic circles. The vice president is a Catholic, but it's not unusual in Catholic circles either. I think that most MAGA adherents, MAGA enthusiasts, would be much more interested in this stuff than J.D. Vance is, quite frankly. But, you know, what's interesting to reflect on is that J.D. Vance is not at all the only senior American politician to talk this way. Ronald Reagan would speculate openly all the time that we might be living in the last days. We might be facing Armageddon soon. And this was seen as alarming by a lot of people in the media and elite culture, but perfectly normal by the kind of people who voted for Reagan.
Do you think these comments, you know, it's important to say they're in a context of talking to a 22-year-old evangelical Christian podcaster, but do you think these comments will do well for J.D. Vance politically?
I don't think they'll hurt him, because most Americans who are inclined to vote Republican already believe this stuff. But of course, the Antichrist end time stuff drew the media's attention, but I don't think it's going to hurt him at all.
But just in terms of, and I haven't read his new book, Communion, Finding My Way Back to Faith, but is this a bigger play
to be Donald Trump's successor. If you've got a book out, you're talking openly about your faith. He doesn't need to be on the promotion circuit when he's the vice president, does he?
He doesn't need to, but I think that he is trying to establish himself as a man of faith. And I think it's genuine. It's not a pose. What's interesting, too, about him is you might remember he got into a fight with Pope Francis about immigration. And Pope Francis said we should welcome all. And J.D. Vance, going back to St. Augustine, who was his patron saint and who helped bring him to Christianity, reading Augustine, J.D. made an Augustinian argument for, no, we have to be charitable to people, but we have a greater loyalty to our own neighbors. And so borders are perfectly Christian. Defending borders is perfectly Christian. Well, when that fight started, I checked with a couple of Augustinian theologians who are specialists in Augustinian political thought, and they said that actually the vice president was more correct, according to St. Augustine, than the Pope, which is pretty startling.
I think that is. Rod, very good to talk to you. Thank you for giving us those insights.
What has the BBC ever done to open our eyes to the world?
Well, it's taken a deep dive into the world of AI.
I don't think anyone really understood what would happen when hundreds of millions of people started using this new technology.
Shared strong opinions from across the country.
Welcome to Question Time. Our audience reflects the general political picture across the nation.
And asked even more difficult questions with Louis Theroux.
You know, because there's a lot of toll that comes with being in the public eye. Do you keep an eye on that?
There's a BBC for each of us, funded by all of us. This is our BBC.
Time for the weather now. Here's Chris Fawkes.
Thanks a lot, Nick. And we've got quite a changeable day coming up today for many of us, starting off with quite a lot of cloud this morning, thinking of a few patches of drizzle here and there, a bit of fog down towards the southwest. And we've got some heavier rain working across Orkney and Shetland. That's going to take a time to clear. After that cloudy start, many areas will brighten up with spells of sunshine developing through this morning, but it'll take a little while before the sunshine reaches southern areas of England today. Into the afternoon, further changes are expected. Now, for Northern Ireland, we'll see a band of rain moving in here through the afternoon and turning increasingly heavy. That rain will then move into northwest England and reach North Wales before the end of the day. Into western Scotland, there'll be lots of heavy showers this afternoon, driven on by a strengthening southwesterly wind. But at the same time, there'll be a bit of sunshine across southern Wales, across much of the Midlands, East Anglia and southern counties of England. Now, a range of temperatures today for Northern Ireland, Scotland, northwest England and Wales, we're looking at highs of around 18 to 22 Celsius. For the Midlands, East Anglia and southern England, rather humid, temperatures could reach 22 to as much as 26 degrees Celsius today. Overnight tonight, we've got some heavy rain pushing in for Northern Ireland, Northern England, North Wales. That sinks southwards across most of Wales, across most of the Midlands and East Anglia. Could be an odd clap of thunder with that. Showers continue across western Scotland. And then tomorrow, that's a band of rain weakening will push into southern England, clearing quite quickly in the morning. And then for tomorrow, broadly speaking, it's a day of sunshine and showers, with some of the showers heavy and frequent across the northwest. It will be very windy for northern Scotland. That's the latest.
Thank you, Chris. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barton and Nick Robinson at the British Museum.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 3rd of September. Good to be with you. The headlines. The BBC's learned that people smugglers in France are running low on boats as the British and French governments announce they're deploying more police to try to stop migrants being crammed onto mega dinghies. The United Nations has warned that the El Niño weather pattern could last until February, heightening the risk of droughts and flooding. And people in London will be able to hail robot taxis from today. Do you fancy it? But the cars will still have a human supervisor at the wheel.
And we're live in the gallery of the British Museum as men with a trolley have just arrived. They are going to unveil, section by section, the thousand-year-old tapestry. It's emerging from under its protective covers as it's only allowed to see the light for a limited number of hours per day. The ancient linen has survived for almost 1,000 years, pretty much everything that nature could have thrown of it, and they don't want to mess it up now. Joining me in a moment, three very excited children from Hastings who will see the tapestry for the very first time, along with the chair of the British Museum, George Osborne, the former Chancellor. A moment of history, as the Prime Minister put it last night. So why does it matter here and now and for a new generation? All that after the BBC News read for us this morning by Jane Steele.
BBC News has found criminal groups who smuggle people to the UK across the English Channel are running low on boats, which is in part leading them to use bigger, more crowded vessels. In an attempt to tackle the mega dinghies, Britain and France will today announce that dozens more officers will be deployed on French beaches to stop the launches. Our Paris correspondent James Waterhouse reports from northern France.
People smugglers are frustrated and have told our sources they're having to change tactics. It's thought greater enforcement action has contributed to them running out of boats. They're instead using larger vessels, and these are departing from areas away from the Calais to Dunkirk stretch to try to avoid the French police. They're also charging the migrants more, now up to €2,000 each, and pressuring them to pay in cash instead of making money transfers. Migrants are now often having to wait months instead of weeks to successfully cross and are often staying closer to the beach to improve their chances of making a journey.
The latest initiative to try to stop the small boat crossings comes as Andy Burnham prepares to host the French President Emmanuel Macron at Downing Street for the first time since becoming Prime Minister. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
Last night, the President and the Prime Minister admired the biotapestry on loan to the British Museum. Today, they'll focus not on historic cross-channel conflict, but contemporary cooperation. The UK and France are to boost police numbers to stop the launch of mega-dinghies from the French coast. Downing Street said a surge team of 45 French officers would be deployed in the coming weeks, and that a total of more than 1,000 personnel were now involved in attempting to stop the boats. While the number of crossings was at a seven-year low this summer, the Prime Minister has said the UK can't be complacent. The Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Philp, said the government had failed to smash the gangs and that UK financial support should be withheld until the French authorities prevent all embarkations in shallow waters.
The King has described the loan of the Bayeux Tapestry as the best possible symbol of the lasting bond between the UK and France. He had a private viewing of the medieval treasure along with President Macron and Andy Burnham at the British Museum last night. The curator of the exhibition, Michael Lewis, told us the measures they've taken to ensure the tapestry's safety will also allow viewers to see the work in a new way.
It was a directive from the French state that here, for this exhibition, it's going to be flat. But that does allow us, for the first time, to show the tapestry in a continuous length, which hasn't been the case for many years. In fact, probably since the 1700s, when it was sort of rolled out for people to see. So, it's a significant thing that we can do that.
The UN's World Meteorological Organization has warned the current El Niño weather pattern could last until at least February. The phenomenon causes surface temperatures to rise in the Pacific Ocean, increasing the risk of droughts and floods in different parts of the world. The Met Office has already warned that this year's El Niño could be the strongest in living memory, possibly leading to more wet and stormy weather in the UK this autumn and winter. Our climate reporter Mark Poynting has more.
In today's report, UN scientists say they're nearly 100% certain that El Niño will continue until at least February, the surest they've ever been. Sea temperatures in a key area of the Pacific are already rivaling some of the highest ever observed there, months before El Niño's expected peak around Christmas. If the forecasts play out, scientists say they expect unusually dry weather in large areas of Southeast Asia, Central America and the Amazon in the next few months, raising the risk of droughts, while parts of Eastern Africa, Southern Brazil and the Southern US could face wetter conditions, increasing the chances of flooding.
Kuwait says it has intercepted a missile and drone attack from Iran, the latest flare-up in violence in the Middle East. Iranian state television said Tehran was targeting US bases in Kuwait in response to what it described as America's crimes against the Iranian people. On Tuesday night, the US and Iran carried out their biggest exchange of attacks since July, with Tehran claiming that a wedding in the south of the country was hit. The Pentagon insists it doesn't target civilians. The funerals are taking place for two Palestinian teenagers who local officials say were killed in an attack on their village by Israeli settlers and soldiers. The Israelis say they came under attack when they went to retrieve livestock. The deaths come amid a recent surge in settler violence in the occupied West Bank. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
A local official in Al Mughayyah told the BBC that the two Palestinians aged 16 and 19 were killed as they tried to stop Israeli settlers stealing sheep and that confrontations broke out. The Israeli military stated that its forces had entered the village to provide security for an Israeli civilian and police trying to retrieve livestock. It said they fired on and struck what it called key instigators of a violent disturbance in which Palestinians threw stones at its troops. Al Mughayyah, near Ramallah, has seen repeated settler attacks. Israeli social media posts have indicated that settlers hope to force its population to move. The latest deaths bring to 81 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces or settlers in the West Bank since the start of the year, according to UN figures.
The government has named and shamed more than 600 employers who failed to pay their staff the national minimum wage. The report says the DIY chain B&Q didn't pay more than £450,000 to about 4,500 staff. The company said the shortfalls were unintentional and everyone had been paid in full in July last year. The Port of Tyne is calling on the International Maritime Organization to quickly enforce rules which make the transportation of plastic pellets safer. Tons of the pellets, known as nurdles, were washed up along the coast after two ships collided at the port in North Shields, posing risks to fish and birds. Our North of England correspondent Fiona Trott reports.
It was the worst incident the port had ever seen. 7 weeks ago, two vessels collided. The cause is still being investigated, but the Port of Tyne says 17 tonnes of tiny plastic pellets or nurdles spilled out onto the river within seconds. Campaigners have asked why it took 3 days for a floating boom to be deployed to stop them from spreading. The port said it acted as quickly as it was allowed to, based on health and safety guidance. Today, it's calling on the International Maritime Organization to enforce tighter rules more quickly to make the transportation of the pellets safer. The IMO says it's already working towards this, and member states are developing a mandatory code or binding regulations which cover freight containers.
Survivors of a police shooting in apartheid-era South Africa are beginning legal moves to overturn a law which shielded those responsible from criminal charges or civil claims. 69 people were killed and 180 injured at a peaceful protest in Sharpeville in 1960. If successful, victims and relatives would be able to collectively bring a claim against the current state. South Africa's government said it had supported victims of apartheid-era violence, with a total of £23 million of grants being issued to some survivors. People in London will be able to book a driverless robot taxi from today. There will be 15 of them in Uber's initial fleet, but they'll still have a human at the wheel as a safety precaution. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman has been for a ride.
My robo-taxi took most of the challenges found on London streets in its stride. Roadworks, a protest outside Parliament, and even some emphatic hand gestures from a cyclist. But the Uber safety driver did choose to intervene in a tight spot with a parked van and a swinging door. Originally, it was hoped that a large number of self-driving rides might be operating in the capital by Christmas. That's looking increasingly unlikely. Regulators have faced criticism for being slow, but they say it's important to get this right.
The BepiColombo Colombo mission to explore Mercury will begin its arrival at the planet today, 8 years after its launch. Two probes will separate from the module that carried them there and will eventually orbit the rocky world which is closest to the sun. Here's our science correspondent Victoria Gill.
This is a milestone for the joint European and Japanese mission to Mercury, which is the smallest and least explored planet in our solar system. At around lunchtime today in Europe, the large module that has carried two probes on their journey to Mercury will detach and drift away. That split marks the end of an 8-year journey. The two spacecraft will then begin the manoeuvre that will eventually lead them into orbiting Mercury together before separating from each other later this year and beginning a detailed scientific investigation, mapping the planet and studying its composition and its magnetic field. It's a mission that aims to reveal more about the formation and the history of the inner planets of our solar system.
Victoria Gill reporting.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It is now 8:10. Good morning once again from the British Museum, where I've been lucky enough to get a golden ticket to see the Bayeux Tapestry before the doors are thrown open in a week's time and an expected million visitors. will come to see this extraordinary piece of history displayed outside France for the first time in almost 1,000 years. Now, the staff here have only just finished rolling back the black felt cloth that protects the tapestry, almost 1,000 years old, from what might impact it, despite the fact that it has survived almost, it seems, untouched, undamaged for so very long. And it is an awe-inspiring spectacle. I've seen the tapestry before, but never like this. At its full length, 70 metres, and displayed flat for the first time, as well as for the first time outside France itself. And it captures this tapestry, not just the great drama of the battle that so many of us learnt about at school, 1066, and all that, but the history, the narrative that led up to it. And in its margins, joyful rendition of the life of the time. So much that we can learn from the people displayed in this tapestry and also from the men, but largely women, who created it. Now, last night, the King and Queen, the President of France, the Prime Minister were here. We'll hear a little from them in just a few minutes, as well as from the chair of the museum, George Osborne. But first, also with a golden ticket, Polly, Oliver, Lottie, join me, school children from Mulberry West Primary School in St Leonard's near Hastings, who've never seen it before, and like me, have had their first look. Oliver, what did you make of it?
I thought that it was really cool and shocking how it's managed, how the people have managed to so detailedly shown how all the armour is and how the shields are all perfectly shaped and the arrows.
I think it's the surprise, isn't it, that you get? You think something this old can't be in this perfect a condition.
No, I actually thought it would be having bits missing, burnt blood, but it didn't.
And it's quite a picture, isn't it? Lottie, what did you make of it?
I thought that it was really impressive because one scene can take so long to sew, and they've done this by hand, not by sewing machines, and it's so cool, all the effort and patience they put into this.
And finally, Polly, what do you think about it?
I really like how the whole tapestry shows the beginning of the Battle of Hastings and what like led up to it. And I really like how detailed it is. It just shows more of it.
And you're going to get the chance to have a much longer look because you've only had a couple of minutes. And we'll come back to you later in the programme. Will you choose a favourite bit for our listeners?
I will most likely choose a favourite bit.
Yeah, lovely. And you can work out, because there's a great historical controversy, whether the arrow in Harold's eye, was it there all the time, or was it added much later? We'll come back then to Polly and to Oliver and to Lottie. But let's join now George Osborne, former Chancellor at the Exchequer, of course, Chairman of the British Museum, who greeted the dignitaries last night and the other guests here. Morning to you, George.
Good morning. Great
now,
to be on.
Of course, for you and for those who helped run this wonderful museum, you joked that it was the best in the world, but you wouldn't say that in front of the French president. Maybe there were two great museums. It's a fantastic exhibition for anybody who comes here. Is it more than that? Is this a moment in history?
Well, I think it's the show of my lifetime anyway. I mean, there have been great shows in the past like Tutankhamun. But for me and for my generation and those younger than me, this is the great show, and over a million people are going to come and see it. And by the way, if you haven't got your ticket yet, we are putting tickets on sale on the 21st of October, hundreds of thousands more tickets going on sale. Does it represent something? Well, you know, I had a very extraordinary experience. You know, I was very privileged to be able to show the King and the Queen and the President around and the Prime Minister. And there's a coronation scene here of Harold. And the King says, well, that looks just like my coronation. In other words, it's part of our past, but it's also part of our future and our current history. And of course, that relationship with France, you know, is one of Britain's critical, enduring relationships. And so it's a spectacle in its own right, as you were just saying. Just to see it in this gallery, I don't think anyone will not be kind of overwhelmed by it, because it's just incredible to see. But it's also woven into our island story and its future.
Everyone who spoke last night, not just you, not just the Prime Minister, but the President and the King as well, talked about the importance of it. Let's hear a little bit from them and what they thought. First of all, let us hear from President Macron.
The tale of two countries, which after centuries of shared history,
choose to forge a bond as close as the threads of this thousand-year-old embroidery. Long live culture. Long live the friendship between France and the United Kingdom. Longue vie à l'entente cordiale et longue vie à l'entente amicale.
The King echoed that sentiment. He was a supporter of the project from the start.
May this tapestry and the treasures that will travel in return stand as symbols not only of our shared past, but our shared future.
And following the King, the Prime Minister called it a moment of history, a tremendous demonstration of goodwill, and opened with perhaps a fitting historical analogy.
A tapestry that shows a new leader emerging from a northern territory, travelling to the south of England in search of the crown. Something clearly that couldn't happen today.
A joke he enjoyed and everybody else here enjoyed. So when I caught up with him very briefly, I put it to him that he'd had some fun with the modern, the contemporary echoes of what was happening. You had a nice jag at your own expense.
A little. Yeah. You've got to, haven't you? But it's just a wonderful occasion, this, isn't it? It's real history. And it's a good reminder that we're all bound up together, aren't we, in these divisive times in which we've lived. Delve back a bit and you see we're all mixed up together. And I thought the words of the French president were really inspiring, actually. So it's great to host him. He's made a huge gesture towards Britain. It's good to be able to thank him tonight in person for that.
He says when you come together, you can do anything. Anything is possible. What do you hope for?
Well, that's the spirit I've been channeling since I've come in. Anything is possible. It's time to be more hopeful again, more optimistic about the future. It's been a difficult decade, and we do need to break out of it and look to the future with a bit more unity and a bit more positivity.
Listening to that, still with me here at the British Museum, smiling as he heard a new Prime Minister try and tell us that all would be well, is George Osborne. There's a serious point, though, for you as an ex-politician, isn't there? It would have been very easy, wouldn't it, for President Macron to say, given all the challenges he's faced, maybe we won't send it over the channel. Maybe that's for another few decades.
Oh, look, lots of people have been involved in putting this exhibition on. Lots of diplomats, amazing curators here at the British Museum and in Bayeux. But there is no doubt it would not have happened without President Macron. I mean, he overrode all the objections. There were plenty of stories of people who said it couldn't travel. There were objectors in France. But he wanted it to happen, you know, and I spent quite a lot of time with him yesterday, because not just because I think he appreciates the kind of beauty of it and, you know, that culture is very important, but I think he wants it to be a diplomatic gesture towards the UK as his own presidency comes to the end, that you are part of Europe. We, you know, for all that has happened over the last decade or so with Brexit, you're part of the European family and we've got to find a way to make it work.
Is that what's in it for him? Because it's obvious what's in it for the British side. The Bayeux Tapestry has much less historical significance for the French. I spoke to quite a lot of French people in the audience yesterday who said their friends barely knew what it was.
No, look, in Britain, I would say in British history, it's the single most famous item in British history. I mean, you can think of Stonehenge, but we can't move that to the British Museum. And the Magna Carta is just, you know, a very important document, but not much to look at. You know, this is the single most studied, imitated, copied item in British history, copied in classrooms, in art classes. You know, the moment you see it, even if you've never seen it, you go, oh my God, that's the Bayeux Tapestry. But you're right, in France it isn't. I think there's significance here that President Macron grew up in northern France, and actually people from northern France, including the culture minister who you spoke to earlier, you know, they actually do know more about it, and it's more part of their history than the rest of France.
And it's telling it away that the Sun would put it on its front cover this morning. Now, they did it in order to mock the French president and the French government for not doing enough to deal with the small boats, but the imagery of the Bayeux Tapestry is there. Do you understand why there is still that frustration? President Macron is aware enough that he didn't want to take any questions last night when I was here at the British Museum. The frustration with France that they're not doing enough to help solve the small boats crisis.
Well, I'm not any longer in charge of things. But, you know, I was hearing your report on the radio this morning. And, you know, I think the combined efforts seem to be at least reducing the numbers and dealing with the overcrowded boats and the horrific deaths in the channel. I mean, fundamentally, I think the point he makes
and I, you know, this is not about reopening old arguments, is that, you know, Britain is not going to be able to solve some of the big challenges it faces on security, the threat from Russia, you know, global regulation of technology like AI, immigration alone. You know, that is a myth. And our history and our future is interconnected with the continent we are part of. And we have got to find a way to work with them. And steps have been taken in that direction. Rishi Sunak took some steps. Keir Starmer took some steps. And clearly, you know, the Andy Burnham government and future British governments are not going to succeed if we are completely isolated from our neighbours on the key issues of the day.
You mentioned Andy Burnham. You heard him there. You smiled as he tried to say, look, I'm trying to be positive. Thinking back to the days when you were Chancellor, if you were seeing what the global bond markets are doing now, if you were seeing that we are now paying more to borrow money, Britain is, than at any time since the financial crisis, how worried would you be?
Well, it does remind me a bit of my first budget. I was lucky enough to give several budgets. But, you know, that very first budget, I was really worried about how the bond market would react to this new coalition government. Would the government survive? And would it take decisive measures to deal with Britain's debt? And, you know, that is a challenge for John Healey. I know John and, you know, I have a lot of respect for him. But he's, you know, hugely constrained by the politics of the country and the Parliamentary Labour Party, as Keir Starmer found out, by the fact that there's a limit to how much taxes can go up without damaging enterprise, and many people think we're beyond that limit, and then the bond market. So if you can't cut spending and you can't raise taxes very much and you can't borrow more, you are, you know, really in a bind. There is something I agree with Andy Burnham about, and I've known him for many years. You know, I think we've got to create a bit more positivity about the country and the economy. But for me, that's also about engaging the private sector and businesses and entrepreneurs. And that's what, you know, Healey, if he wants to pull a surprise, he can actually do, this is an unusual thing for me to say, what Gordon Brown did in one of his first budgets, which was a big boost for entrepreneurs with capital gains tax, surprised everyone, Labour Chancellor. But in some ways, it was, you know, worked even more effectively precisely because of that.
A free tip from a former Tory Chancellor. Let's end, though, with optimism and hope and this extraordinary spectacle that we're looking at. I've been asking everybody for a favourite moment, beyond the obvious, which is the arrow in the eye. What is it that you love seeing here?
Well, the odd thing about this tapestry is you think it's, you know, if you haven't seen it, oh, it's just like William arrives and conquers England. But William and Harold are friends before this happens. And there's an extraordinary scene where the French or the Norman soldiers are caught in quicksand, essentially, on their way to Brittany. And Harold personally kind of lifts these Norman soldiers, who are later going to kill him, out of the quicksand and rescues them. And it's because it's also a story of kinship as well as rivalry and death.
George Osborne, Chair of the British Museum, thank you very much. Thank you for having us and hosting us here. And we're here as part of a big day on Radio 4. Radio 4's Norman Day, celebrating the tapestry being in here in Britain after so long. Katie Razzle will be along to explain more in just a few minutes' time about the great programming that you can hear across the network over the next few hours.
24 minutes past eight. Well, keeping with French-British relations, but not regarding a mammoth tapestry instead, small boat crossings happening very much in real life. That will be top of the agenda when President Macron meets with Andy Burnham at Downing Street today. Summer small boat crossings have fallen to their lowest level in 7 years. But while there may have been fewer boats crossing on a relative basis, the boats have been getting bigger, firstly, with more people on them. And last month, just to give you an illustration, we saw a 15-metre long dinghy with a record 230 people on it. But also, while we say the numbers crossing the Channel are significantly down, it's still in the tens of thousands. So what will finally work and drive those numbers significantly down and keep them down? Anna Turley's here, Minister of State for Border Security and Asylum at the Home Office. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
So one of the just details is around dozens more police officers deployed. Is that really going to move the dial? You know, the idea of extra police and French police especially, you know, there's a quite uncharitable, you would probably say, a headline in the Sun newspaper today saying 45 extra 45 French do nothing cops.
I think that's just part of the armoury that we're working with the French to deliver. And that's why I'm really pleased that the Prime Minister's welcoming President Macron to number 10 today, because this is going to be top of the agenda. And I think I'm really pleased to see that that's the case. We, as you said, have made good progress so far. We've seen the lowest summer of crossings for 7 years now, which is a testament to the hard work that's been put in and the partnership and cooperation we've had with the French, particularly since the Home Secretary signed an agreement in April this year, which essentially was a payment by results relationship, so that it's giving the French more support on that coast and upstream to tackle the gangs and to stop the flow of people coming to the beaches and crossing over. But yeah, I mean, 45 officers on their own would not be enough to solve the problem. We're absolutely clear about that. But it's part of a wider deployment. We now have over 1,000 specially trained officers on those beaches of France. They are doing all sorts of work, from the actual sort of intervention on the beach, but also upstream, dealing with sort of data, the intelligence, dealing with the sort of fabrication and building of the boats, breaking up the gangs, and dealing with the sort of organised crime aspect of this as well. So it's part of a sustained programme that we've got with the French and working cross borders all the way up the supply chain.
I suppose, can I be specific around the French authorities doing enough to intercept boats once they get into the water? That's what the concern is about. And what can you say on that? Because, you know, if you look at it, and there's real concern that, you know, it's not working. It's still not going to work. There's recent reporting of armed French officers simply watching boats load in knee-deep water with orders not to intervene. What are you doing about that?
Yeah, I think a lot of that, I'm afraid there's a lot of misconception around that. I'm not saying that some boats aren't getting through, but we are stopping a huge number of boats. We've stopped 48,000 crossings since the election due to the action that the French police are taking. There have been a number of videos circulated over the last few weeks that visibly show them going to the boats, slashing them, pushing people back, being at the time, you know, bombarded with stones and bricks and coming under, you know, a lot of challenge to do that. So they are intervening. We only often see the boat and hear about the boats that get through, but every day they're making those disruptions. Every day they're stopping those boats.
So has there been a change with interception of boats in the water? Just to give an example, last Thursday, nearly 500 migrants arrived in the UK in just one day. Mm-hmm. 7 vessels successfully making the crossing in one day. Has there been a change?
Well, so we've had a real surge since April, particularly in terms of the amount of volume of enforcement that they've been undertaking. The French do make interventions in the water, so that is a bit of a misconception. They do that, but obviously they have to make a decision. We had 2 deaths. The day that Chris Philp was out on the French beaches pointing at boats, we had 2 people die in the channel, and the French have to make a decision about the risk to life. Even in shallow water, these deaths occur. So they have to make that decision, as do all maritime agencies. The priority is to stop people getting onto the shores and getting onto the boats in the first instance, and then to intervene as far as they possibly can to stop them getting into the waters. That's the priority, and that's why I say we've got over 1,000 officers now deployed especially to do this, working with the French, and we use other technology, drones and scanners and other sort of
as you said that, I suppose. Has there been a change in that interception point? Will the French authorities intercept a boat in the water now?
They do. Yes, they do.
They do.
They do regularly. Yeah, absolutely.
That doesn't depend on how many people are on the boat, because there's now concerns about mega dinghies.
Yeah, of course. Part of the reason we've
it's because of safety reasons. That's what's been cited as the reason. So it's not about, you know, as some have characterised it always as not doing it or not wanting to do it, but you're saying that is the case.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I say we've certainly increased that activity since April, since the payment by results agreement has come into place.
How,
we know that's having an effect. But I said they are intervening in those waters.
Do you have a realistic goal, just before I very quickly ask you a final thing, do you have a realistic goal as to when this will be a significantly small number? So it's lower, as you've said. There's stuff to very much talk about and give us that detail on, as you have. But when do you think it will be in the low numbers?
Yeah, well, like I said, I'm not going to make a prediction yet. We've just been through the most challenging part of the year, which is the summer. And I said I'm really pleased that this summer's been the lowest for nearly 7 years. We're not going to do a victory lap at all. We've got so much more work still to do. The Prime Minister himself has said we're going to be relentless on this. So I'm not going to put a target date on it, but we're redoubling our efforts, as you've seen today, with more investment, not just on those officers on the French beaches, but interventions in terms of supporting the French with intelligence, with judicial, so we can actually bring people to justice and smash the gangs and stop this whole industry at source.
Okay.
This is the intervention that we're making. We'll continue to bear down on it going forward.
No target yet, but
Not yet, but you can judge us on our results as they come through, and we're being relentless.
Diane Abbott, obviously a very well known, till recently not in the Labour Party, but readmitted to the Labour Party in July, 2 weeks into Andy Burnham's premiership. On Wednesday, yesterday, on X, formerly known as Twitter, she put out this post. She said the imminent threat from Russia is a NATO fiction to justify their complete capitulation to Trump's demands for more military spending. The increase should not go ahead. Is it OK for her to say that there's NATO fiction, especially in the climate we're in? Should she keep the Labour whip?
I think she's fundamentally wrong. I completely disagree with Diane on that.
Is it
the first time we've disagreed? I think she's wrong. I'm really proud of not just this Prime Minister, the previous Prime Minister, and actually across all parties, the solidarity we've shown with Ukraine. We've stood side by side with them in the face of Russian aggression and onslaught. I'm proud of the position this government's taken.
You're proud of that, but you disagree with Diane Abbott. Should she keep the Labour whip?
Well, that would be a decision for the Chief Whip, I'm afraid. That's not for me to make that decision. But
But what do you think? What's your opinion? As a Labour MP and as a Minister, should Diane Abbott keep the whip?
My opinion, she's wrong. She's in the wrong place on this. I disagree fundamentally, firmly with her, and I'm happy to say so publicly. And I will, the Chief Whip is the person that will make that decision, and I'll wait for them to make their decision on that.
Anna Turley, Minister of State for Border Security and Asylum at the Home Office. Thank you.
28 minutes to nine now. Time for the sport. Here's Mike.
Thank you, Nick. Let's start in New York, shall we? Because you don't often see this at a Grand Slam tennis match.
I mean, that was incredible. Well, look at them there. Yeah. Two birds sitting on the net. How are they not moving before? I've never seen that before in my life.
Yes, two birds flew down and perched on the net in the middle of a rally at the US Open yesterday. You heard commentary of the incident from Sky Sports just there. The two little sparrows thankfully avoided injury despite balls whizzing past them at 90 miles an hour, but they did force the point in Daniil Medvedev's match to be replayed.
Do you really not see the two birds sitting on the net in the middle of the point?
No, I saw them straight away. And I thought the point would stop straight away, but it didn't. Then we played for 45 seconds. And the moment I hit the winner, we say stop. I'm like, why? I was not happy with the decision, but well, it is what it is.
Yeah, remarkable incident. You can see that video of that online now. But let's talk tennis of a different kind now, shall we? And hear from one of the biggest names in British tennis.
A huge smile on the face of Alfie Hewitt of Great Britain, who raises his arms in victory. He's the gold medal winner today.
Yes, Britain's Alfie Hewitt is the current world number two in wheelchair singles tennis, where he has 10 Grand Slam titles to his name, and the world number one in wheelchair doubles, where he's won a staggering 25 Grand Slam titles. He's also only one of two men's wheelchair tennis players to have completed the career Grand Slam. And I'm delighted to say Alfie joins us on the programme now. Hi, Alfie.
Good morning.
So I know you fly out to America tomorrow, don't you, ahead of the wheelchair championships starting at the US Open next Tuesday. You've won four singles titles at the US Open, more than any other Grand Slam, I think. What do you love about playing in New York?
Yeah, it's an event that I've loved since day one of being there. My first time playing there in 2017 was a memorable experience, and following up the following year with a victory was one that I enjoyed, and I wish I knew the secret to playing so well in New York, because I'd try and replicate it elsewhere. But you know, it's obviously such a lively atmosphere in the grounds, and it's an event that I've just particularly played well and feel confident in.
We mentioned the incredible number of Grand Slam titles you already have to your name, 35 across both singles and doubles, and yet you are still only 28. So presumably you still feel you have a lot more gas left in the tank.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I have no ambitions on stopping with those numbers anytime soon. But, you know, it's a difficult sport and there's no guarantees. So this year's been particularly challenging in the singles event with Takito Oda claiming all three so far this year. So I think there's a lot of people that want to try and stop him from winning the calendar slam in the singles. And from a double side of things, You know, I'm really enjoying playing with Gordon Reid still. You know, it's a 10-year relationship that's brought a lot of success, but we definitely don't have any plans on stopping anytime soon.
You are one of, if not the highest profile wheelchair athletes in British sport currently. You are an ambassador for disability sport, and that is a role I know you take very seriously, so much so you're taking your message, aren't you, into schools to support disabled children who want to pursue a career in sport.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very exciting times away from the tennis court. I'm very proud to say that we've got an initiative up and running from today, which is called Get In and Go. And essentially that is a project where we will travel around the UK and any schools, sports centres, clubs, I've even said birthday parties out there who want to hire a sports wheelchair can do this via the website. And essentially our mission is to try and create more opportunities and expose disabled and non-disabled kids to participate in wheelchair sports. Sport, I believe, is such a great way to be able to connect people and can be a very powerful tool, I think, in changing those perceptions. And, you know, whether it's starting a disabled person's sporting journey or giving the experience to someone who's not disabled is something that I think is really powerful to have that perspective and to inspire the next generation, really, to become wheelchair sport fans. So it's something that I'm really excited about, and I encourage people to look into it a little bit more, and hopefully we can create some more sporting stars.
Well, we wish you all the best with that project. Just finally, as you prepare to head out to the USA, how confident are you of returning home in 10 days' time or so with a fifth US Open wheelchair singles title?
Well, I'm trying to go into it as confident as I can, so ask me that question in 10 days' time.
We shall certainly do that. Alfie Hewitt, good luck in the USA. Many thanks for joining us on the programme.
Thank you for having me.
Mike, thank you. We are now getting stuck back into Normanday, which is what it is all day here on Radio 4. I've not said that before. Katie Razzle has just joined me in the studio, who's going to be taking this on after 9 o'clock. Katie, what have you got? And you're here, you're not at the British Museum.
I am here. Well, Nick is witnessing the incredible unveiling this morning, but I was at the British Museum yesterday for the King and President Macron's private tour of the tapestry, and I too have seen it in all its glory.
Yes, I did say Normanday without saying Bayeux tapestry.
You did.
Stitching it together.
Absolutely. But this morning, I'm going to be looking but beyond the story of the tapestry to ask how the Normans set about dominating the country, their impact on every element of their life and their legacy. Was England colonised? What survived of the Saxons, and why do we think of them as heroes? And does the Norman past really matter in Britain as well as France today? We've got historians and writers to answer those questions. That's What Did the Normans Ever Do For Us? With me this morning, just after nine.
I like the echoes of what the BBC did for us. Well done. as our culture woman. Very, very clever. Katie, we look forward to that.
And I'm having the joy here of just sneaking a look in between items on the programme. Lucky me with my golden ticket of the tapestry. I'm right in front of the battle scene. It's worth remembering that this 70 metres has a whole lot more than the Battle of Hastings. There's life leading up to the battle with some wonderful scenes capturing the moment of preparation, play fighting with toy swords, as looks like, all those deliveries of wine that the King spotted last night. But I'm reminded here, seeing the tapestry now just in front of me, you can get really kind of nose close to this glass case to look of how graphic, how dramatic the scenes are that are captured of a battle that the historians say lasted all day, which was unusual in those days. And, you know, here are the heads rolling on the ground, the horses that are paid with their lives too, the grimaces on the faces here. It's a scene of huge drama, and we're going to hear from our three young people, school children, I'm sorry, from Hastings, what they've made of it all in just a few minutes' time. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, live with me, Nick Robinson, at the British Museum, with Emma Barnett in the studio, alongside Jane Steele, who's got a summary of the news.
BBC News has learned that criminal groups who smuggle people to the UK across the English Channel are running low on boats, which is in part leading them to use bigger, more crowded vessels. In an attempt to tackle the mega dinghies, Britain and France will announce that 45 more French officers will be sent to the country's beaches to stop the launches. The Home Office Minister Anna Turley told us the deployment was part of a sustained programme and the French were intervening every day. The Conservatives accused the government of failing to smash the gangs. The King has described the loan of the Bayeux Tapestry to the UK as the best possible symbol of the lasting bond with France. He visited the medieval treasure along with President Macron and the Prime Minister at the British Museum last night. The chair of the museum, George Osborne, told us the tapestry was the single most famous item in British history, and President Macron had intended its loan to be a diplomatic gesture. The government has named and shamed more than 600 employers who failed to pay their staff the legal minimum wage. Over an undisclosed period, some companies have underpaid workers by hundreds of thousands of pounds. The BepiColombo mission to explore Mercury will begin its arrival at the planet today, 8 years after its launch. Two unmanned probes will separate from the module that carried them there and will eventually orbit the rocky world.
Jane, thank you. It's 19 minutes to nine. Let me take you to Spain. Protests involving thousands of people taking place in cities across the country over the government's handling of the influx of migrants to the Spanish enclave of Ceuta on the North African coast. In the last half hour, the Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has been addressing Parliament for the first time since the arrival of more than 70,000 migrants in just 2 days at the end of July.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. As the Speaker of Congress said, I'm appearing before you to discuss the migrant crisis in Ceuta and the solutions that the government is implementing. I do this thinking about the people of Ceuta, who are going through a difficult time. I do it thinking about the 141 migrants who died in the sea, many of them youngsters and children. And I want to thank, once again, the thousands of civil servants who worked tirelessly to overcome the many crises we've had over the last few years.
Listening to that, Guy Hedgeco, our reporter who's been watching Mr. Sanchez's speech this morning. Guy, is he getting it right? Is he at one with his people?
Good morning, Emma. Well, he is certainly under a huge amount of pressure. We saw that yesterday with this demonstration here in Madrid and other demonstrations around the country, which were expressions of support for Ceuta, but they were also pretty much anti-government protests, suggesting that the government has not got this right. The government is facing a lot of questions that Pedro Sanchez is facing this morning in Parliament. Could it have prevented this mass crossing of migrants on July the 30th and 31st? He's been saying just now that the intelligence services didn't have enough information to know about that mass crossing. But another question, and this is really key, is who was responsible for this? Pedro Sanchez has said that those responsible were people traffickers and far-right agitators from outside Spain. But many people here in Spain blame Morocco. And yesterday, a police report came out suggesting just that Morocco or Morocco's security forces may have been behind this the crossing of migrants into Spanish territory at the end of July. So this is a very difficult one for Pedro Sanchez because he's having to deal with a logistical challenge, these several thousand migrants who remain in the city of Ceuta. But it's also a political challenge as well, and he's having to explain his relationship with Morocco, whether or not he's being too indulgent with that bilateral relationship.
Guy, thank you very much. Well, listening to that and joining us now, Juan López Aguilar, politician of the Spanish Socialist Workers' Party, former justice minister. Juan, welcome to the programme. I mentioned there about the protests across Spain at your government's handling of this. Do you understand why people are so very angry?
I understand certainly that people are concerned because we are facing a huge crisis which has scaled up from its original migratory dimension into a humanitarian situation and certainly a national security challenge, which makes an impact on the bilateral relation not only of Spain with the Kingdom of Morocco, but the European Union in all, because certainly Ceuta, along with Melilla, happens to be the only land border with the African continent of the whole of the European Union, and besides the most unequal external border on Earth. So that poses a huge challenge, and we have to face it. And the government is doing its best, not only investing 170 million euros to recover the normality in Ceuta to begin with, not only 350 million euros, which have also been decided by the Council of Ministers in order to help to address the humanitarian challenge by respecting EU law and by respecting Spanish law, which is certainly careful about the fundamental rights and human rights which are involved, particularly when it comes to youngsters and children. But certainly I do understand that people are in stress, people are in anger, and people are in distress because of the lack of normality and the sensation that we are all under threat in this external border, which I insist is not only Spain, it's the European Union.
So just in terms of that anger and the feeling of being under threat, Spanish prosecutors, I understand, say 23 sexual assaults, including 9 against children, have been recorded in Ceuta since the mass influx of migrants at the end of July. Do you recognise those figures? Because, I mean, that number means that there's almost a case every day. That's what the chief prosecutor has said.
Yes, but it takes a thorough investigation. And according to the data that have been collected by the forces, by the security forces which are deployed in Ceuta, it happens that just a percentage of those sexual assaults have to do with the migrants that have entered irregularly. Swimming, I have to insist, and that is part of the problem, because there was a ruling by the Spanish Supreme Court stating that when they came swimming, they could not be returned on the spot, that there should be a whole legal procedure in order to identify those who have entered. But having said this, there's a large percent of those sexual assaults that have not been committed by migrants themselves, but by people in Ceuta, because many of those who entered swimming irregularly happen to be young female children, young girls. So there's a huge challenge here, certainly. And there are many matters of concern. But the thing is that the government is trying to combine not only the national security dimension, yes, but also with the respect of a human right involved, and of course the respect of EU law, which is extremely demanding. Many people are in anger, just crying out, send them back, send them back. You know, it's not that easy when you respect EU law and when you respect the legal procedures, particularly when it comes to the asylum seekers' claims, yes, which are also part of the issue.
Juan López Aguilar, we're going to have to leave it there, the former Justice Minister of Spain.
The time now is 12 minutes to 9.
Scientists have discovered patterns which may explain why people with 5 different illnesses suffer from chronic exhaustion. Conditions such as ME, long COVID, PTSD, MS and rheumatoid arthritis all cause similar symptoms but have previously been considered separate. Now scientists say they appear deeply connected. Professor Dmitry Prijetsky is a professor at the University of East Anglia and lead researcher of the study into these conditions. Good morning. This sounds,
hello,
it sounds fascinating and also incredibly important because there's still so much mystery concerning these conditions and the element of fatigue.
Yes, absolutely. It's one of those areas where there's not enough research has been done yet. And since there is no blood test for those, for many of those conditions, like ME/CFS or long COVID, a lot of people are always wondering what's happening with me.
And what have you found? What are the links or how have you displayed that?
So for a long time, a lot of different aspects of those conditions were looked at individually. So people looked at different cytokines or different antibodies or various different aspects of the conditions. But this is for the first time that we could actually take a whole epigenetic profile of patients and look at a one giant snapshot of million chromosome conformations at a time. And suddenly we identify massive networks which are overlapping between the conditions.
And those networks show what, or what can it unlock?
It basically shows that there are kind of very similar biological pathways involved in the genome expression deregulation. So basically, if you look at the way your genes are, they're very similar. So there's not huge difference between the people with ME/CFS or people without. But if you look at how the genes are expressed, suddenly you see that there are way more similarities between the various conditions. And that obviously determines the biological outcome. The way your genes are expressed determines the way your body is. And there, that's where we find this new signaling. And that leads to obviously understanding of how it works and how it can be tackled.
And therefore treatments.
Yes. So obviously the next kind of major steps is the diagnosis and treatment. So diagnostic wise, since you see the new patterns, you can make new tests which detect those patterns. And treatment wise, since you know the new hubs and the new kind of pathways which are involved, you can theoretically at least try to find the treatments for those.
And I mean, that is theoretically, but I suppose how long between making this? I mean, I'm trying to understand how seminal is this connection that you've made, and how long could that take to filter through? Because there's a lot of people to action, to treatment, to help, because there are a lot of people listening, I'm sure, who are desperate.
Absolutely. It's these conditions are by far not a gift at all. Many people are very severely disabled because of fatigue and brain fog and post-exertional malaise and all sorts of symptoms which come together with them. Many people lose employment. Many people cannot take care of their children. In terms of how seminal, the most seminal thing about this is that finally we can see a large picture that connects different conditions which we thought were not connected. So you would not think that PTSD has anything in common with, I don't know, long COVID, while actually in reality, the way both conditions develop have a lot of similarities. In terms of how quickly this can be translated to clinic, that's obviously a difficult question to answer. It all depends on obviously how much we can further up in terms of finding individual pathways linked and then do clinical trials to try new medications for those.
Professor Dmitry Projetsky, professor at the University of East Anglia, lead researcher on that fascinating sounding study. Thank you very much indeed.
8 minutes to 9. You join us back in the gallery for the Bayer Tapestry here at the British Museum. And when it was unveiled last night to the Prime Minister, to the President, to the King and Queen, a big theme of Andy Burnham's speech was the importance of as many children as possible getting to see it. And they don't have to pay to come. If you're lucky enough to get a ticket for under 16s, it is free. And that cause, the cause of having as many children as possible, particularly from places that are highlighted in this tapestry, has been focused on by the Labour MP for Hastings, Helena Dollimore, who wants what's dubbed 1066 country to enjoy the history of this moment.
This tapestry quite literally wove our area into national history. So often, the young people that I represent might learn about it in school, but have never had a chance to see it. Since the day I found out, I've been working very hard to make sure that the area I represent in 1066 country is truly a part of this national moment. And for me, that has to start with our young people. I represent an area where we are in the bottom 10 for social mobility, according to the Sutton Trust. 63% of our young people leave school without the basic qualification in maths and English, let alone history. And so this is a big moment with it coming back to this country to say, actually, access to the arts, access to our heritage is for everyone.
Well, with us still, and they've had, what, half an hour or so to be relishing their opportunity to get a unique personal view of the Bayer Tapestry without the crowds are three of her constituents, Polly, Oliver and Lottie, schoolchildren from Mulberry West St Leonard's Primary School in Hastings, are with us once again. You may have heard them at about 10 past 8 when they took their first glance. You've had longer to look, Oliver. What is it that's caught your eye?
What's caught my eye is the vivid symbolic reference of the animals like eating the prey, which is like there's a swan being eaten by a lion, which could mean, like, Harold is the swan and William the Conqueror is the lion, and the lion will always win because he's the predator and the predator always gets the prey.
Yeah, messages woven into the tapestry. Lottie, what about you?
I liked the boat and the detail and the boat and the waves underneath, and I think it was really cool that they were travelling to Pevensey to get ready for battle. And I also like I think you get a picture in your head of what you think the tapestry is going to be like, and then you see it for real and it's just completely different and really good.
Different because?
Because you don't, I think seeing it up close, you can see the detail and the fabulous work that has put, people have put into this.
Amazing work, isn't it, Polly?
Yeah. Something that I really like about the Bayeux Tapestry are the horses, because they only were able to use a couple different dyes. But if I were the person who made the Bayeux Tapestry, I would want to be recognised for it, because it's just so amazing and well done.
It's extraordinary work, isn't it? How lucky you are to be here, and thank you very much. We're lucky to hear your first impressions of it. Well, you can take as long as you like now. You can see as much, because alongside you, we've also got the Poet Laureate here. Everybody's here because it is Norman Day on Radio 4. Our excitement about the Bayeux Tapestry does not stop at 9 o'clock, as you'll hear from Katie Razzle in a minute. It goes on right through the day here on Radio 4. And Simon, you've had, as I understand it, your first ever glimpse of Bayeux Tapestry. I'd seen it in its original location. This is your first sighting. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I've been talking about it and writing about it for a long number of years, but I've never clapped eyes on it. And it's incredibly moving. I mean, you get to the point where you think it doesn't really exist. It's like the Ark of the Covenant or the Holy Grail, and here it is. And there's something very almost sacred about it when you see it. And I guess, you know, what you realise when you're certainly looking at the last stretch of it is that it's very commemorative. The battle scenes there are all remembering people who died, but it's just astonishing. I mean, the length itself, you know, the width of a football field.
Yeah, and you look at it and you think, as we look right down this gallery, how extraordinary long it is. Now, I know you've been writing about it.
Yeah, I'm going to read a little section here. So Halley's Comet is woven into the tapestry, an actual astronomical event, and this is scene 32, when Harold and his men are talking about the comet as an omen. All was smooth and straight until night, when sky watchers spotted a fuzzy star to the east. Soon all hands were pointing out its silver light and bearded tail. I laughed it off as a freak event, waved it aside, but for a week it crossed my window as I tried to sleep. Basted in sweat, I dreamed a fleet of ships were sailing inside me, cruising my bloodstream, bumping and barging into the port of my heart, coming ashore in my head.
More of that. Wonderful words, wonderful poetry from Simon. We can get as part of BBC Radio 4's Norman Day and hosting the first of a whole series of programmes that will last throughout the day. Don't dare tune out, or if you have to, do come back and listen on BBC Sounds. It's Katie Razzle. We heard a little bit from Katie earlier, but she joins us once again. What have you, what has Radio 4 got in store for us, Katie?
Well, hello, Nick. Yes, you're right. You talked earlier about your golden ticket. How lucky are we that we've seen that wonder before almost everyone else? But yes, Norman Day continues here on Radio 4 when you are gone, and no doubt touring the Bayeux Tapestry further. We are looking beyond the Bayeux Tapestry to ask, what did the Normans ever do for us? So everything from how they set about taking over the country to what their impact was on everything from landscape to language, what survived of the Saxons, and what is the Norman legacy today? So we're asking, was England colonised? And does the Norman past really matter in Britain now as well as France? And we are going to be talking to historians and writers to answer those questions. So that's what did the Normans ever do for us with me later on this morning. But Nick, I want to ask you, throw it back at you just before the end of the programme, because I have got a favourite scene and I want you to go and find it afterwards if you haven't talked about it already at the tapestry, which is the woman and child fleeing the building being torched by Norman soldiers. Because if you think there are so few women actually in the tapestry, and when you think about the idea that women were the ones most likely here in England who made it, and then you think those women who embroidered that may well have experienced the Norman invasion, the Norman conquest and the violence of battle. And I just find, looking at that tapestry, that bit incredibly moving.
It is moving. We heard from a historian, a woman